still counting from Volbeat, inching back up one spot to number two. Just one song is left in the books.
This week's number one, like I'm the like Big Daddy Dog numero uno. Number one.
Shinedown takes our top spot for the third straight week. They've recently been tapped to be one of the headliners for this year's Rock Vegas Festival, along with Rob Zombie, Marilyn Manson, and Godsmack. Here's Unity.
I found a nowhere to name and a picture of us. Even though it was framed and covered in dust, it's the map in my mind that sends me on my way. They say it's never too late to stop being afraid. And there is no one else here, so why should I wait? And in the blink of an eye,
Down. It's our number one song for the third straight week. That's it for us this week. If you missed any part of our chart, you can get caught up at thesideshowcountdown.com.
And you can download the free iHeartRadio app and listen to us no matter where you are.
I'm Nikki Sixx.
I'm Carrie Kasem.
We'll see you next weekend.
The Side Show is now over. Go ahead, stick a golden fork in it. We're done.
Now.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Julene.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. Pleasure to be here.
Yes.
You know, people say that kind of pro forma. Everybody says it's a pleasure to be here. It really is a pleasure for us to be here.
It is.
We look forward to doing this every week with you, and one of the few times in radio that you get to be on the air yourself. You can call us at 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
And if you've never heard this show, you're probably saying, why should I call them?
Because there are important things going on.
Yeah, and we talk about them. And yes, we want your opinions. I mean, I guess our announcer said that. We give our opinions, and we want to hear yours. In numerals, the number is? Or did you already say that?
I did.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we'll move on. If you'd like to email us, it's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Short messages may, not for sure, but may be read on the air during the show. Longer ones I'll read and get back to. Wasn't I saying that last week? Sometimes I'm answering things that I got in March.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, what are people thinking? You know,
that's like, my MO. That's usually not yours, though.
How many in your inbox did
I
you say?
I think I have 30,000.
What? No, yeah. No, come on. Yeah. It won't hold that much.
Yeah. I'll look. I'll tell you.
Really? Okay. Well, in my personal one, which I'm not giving out.
No.
It would be, although it wouldn't be, you know what? Never mind. I shouldn't say it, but it probably wouldn't be too hard to guess, but it doesn't matter. Anyway, I now have, well, go ahead. How many do you have?
I'm looking. Go
okay.
Ahead.
I have 63. I was having an anxiety attack because I was up to 130.
I should be dead by now then.
Yeah,
with
I know.
Anxiety.
I know.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, wait. Here we go. Come on. I have, 20,546.
Are you going to answer?
Those are unread emails.
Yeah.
Oh. It's mostly spam. I'm not a snob, I swear.
Don't you have a spam filter on them?
Yeah. I get a bunch of crap, you know?
You know, we haven't, I said this last week, still haven't been doing as much with Facebook as we have been, but please join us. We, you know, you could make it happen, right? I mean, this can be friend-driven.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or like-driven. Facebook.com/nightcall. So get on it, and you can make your ideas known there, your opinions.
Yeah.
You know, one thing, I don't have a Facebook page of my own, and I leave it to you and Debbie to administer it. But I started looking at the photographs, and I realized people are commenting on the photographs. I told you, is this something you'll be told on the air? I can't remember. I told you about one of the photographs.
What?
I can't remember. Is that a... Okay, if we both can't remember...
What are you talking about?
Are we on? Oh, yeah. Yeah, right.
God.
Mike will be answering your phone calls tonight at 313.
Wait a minute. John will be.
John. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mike, somebody else.
Mike's in the other room.
Right. I almost said something, but that's good. I didn't. Anyways, John, who was I thinking of? John will have our podcast available for you at noon on Monday. You know, I hesitate to mention this subject again, but it just keeps coming back at us.
Well, it's not going away, and we're not talking about Chick-fil-A.
No, but maybe we will talk about Chick-fil-A and the kiss-in at this restaurant.
Great.
Where the owner, the CEO, has contributed to these viciously anti-gay organizations, including a group designated as a hate group. So that's why people were all...
Well, and people should be angry. And the people who are following Mike Huckabee, who, remember that guy?
Yeah, sure.
He did run for president.
And he was the governor of Arkansas.
Yeah. He created this Support Chick-fil-A Day. We'll talk about it later, though.
Yeah. But right now we're talking about, another mass murder in the United States. And what is depressing about it besides just that this is the most gun-violent industrial country in the world?
In general.
What were we saying last week? It was, do I still have that?
It's more than the top 22 here. Or whatever.
Yeah, I have it. We're 20 times higher in the gun murder rate than the next 22 richest countries. Of the 23 wealthiest countries, 80% of all gun deaths are American deaths. 87% of all kids killed by guns are American kids.
Yeah.
And so that's pretty depressing.
It's a violent country. And something has to change. Something has to give, Peter.
There's a violent ethos here. Men acting out anger. A few women are pot-shotting.
Well, there's some women throwing out some shots. Come
on
now.
But not,
even the feminist is going to.
But not as much.
The percentage
A lot of angry men for a variety of reasons. But one of the things that's depressing about it is when we talk about it, we get the same old, including me. I mean, I say the same things. You listeners say the same things. And in many ways, what we've come up with is this is just what happens. And
right.
There's no way really to fix it. I mean, people, you know.
It goes along with a lot of what else is going on in the country that people also feel hopeless about it.
Well, yeah, someone was giving me a hard time because I was comparing it to automobile accidents. But I was saying we know for certain that in any given period, like, say, in a year, we know that 32,000 people are going to be killed by cars. You know,
right.
300, 400,000 people are going to get severe injuries. There's going to be $20 billion worth of property damage.
Yeah.
And
they're death machines.
Yeah. And no one says, well, let's abolish the car.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
So, but we
Although
have
public transportation would be wonderful.
Yeah.
More of that.
We do try to make cars safer and safer and safer. So I don't know what to say. If you don't know exactly what we're talking about, there was a shooting at a Sikh temple. That's S-I-K-H, and the Sikhs are a religious. They're often mistaken for Muslims. And they've been the subject of like 700 attacks since September 11th
right.
because they wear turbans and they
and long because beards. People are ignorant
and
and call them you know the
right.
word that goes along with that, and a lot of Sikhs are from India.
Yeah, right. That's where it originated. I think there's about 300,000 Sikhs in the United States. There's a congregation of them in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, south of Milwaukee, and a lone gunman walked in there and killed six people and then was shot to death himself. He shot a police officer, probably legal guns as well. In Akron, Ohio, police say a 66-year-old man entered a hospital intensive care unit and shot his 65-year-old wife while standing at her bedside.
Now, at first, when I read that, I thought maybe he can't pay for her health care. Maybe she's suffering and she wants.
Maybe it was compassion.
Maybe it was compassion, but he's been charged with murder.
Yeah. In Warren, Michigan, right near us, police say a dispute over how much two men were going to pay for a female escort, that's also a prostitute if you didn't figure that out, led to an early morning shooting. Warren police officer Donald Veers, an 8-year veteran, was shot in the stomach but was saved from serious injury because of his bulletproof vest.
Wow. You know, it's like, why don't these guys just go and get themselves a box of Kleenex and call it a day?
Well, okay. A 44-year-old man surrendered to police and was charged with attempted murder in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, after an assault rifle attack in a bar left 17 wounded.
Yeah.
This kind of fell beneath the cracks. And he confessed immediately. He said, I wanted to die and was hoping the Tuscaloosa police would kill me, but I got scared and left the bar.
Now you will suffer.
Yeah.
I mean, 17 people and one... I think one of them's in critical, three in serious, one in stable, and the rest have gone home. Fortunately, no one died in that incident. And it's true, Peter, when you said swept under the rug. And how could something like that, to that extent, it's huge, in my opinion, get swept under? Well, maybe because it's such a violent country and no one died.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, the other common comment we get is, well, if everybody in that bar would have been armed.
Yeah, then they could all shot each other.
Well, maybe. It's like I always say, you never can tell.
I think that's the most stupid argument I've ever heard.
Yeah.
Honestly, I'm just so annoyed. I'm over that argument.
I don't want to be in a bar with people that are armed.
No, I mean, alcohol, it creates, anger. People get angry good and angry and honest when they drink.
You know, and most people that will call and talk forthrightly and honestly about, say, carrying a gun are probably the people, or I would say almost exclusively, aren't the people that are going to be a problem.
That it's cool that you have them.
I still say there's very, 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 very little need for anyone to carry a gun.
Yeah.
If you're like middle class or, I don't even know. I mean, there's tons of people in poor areas that are carrying guns and the Chicago is everybody supports.
The ban on handguns, right?
Is there a ban on handguns?
I believe so.
Well, they must have declared that unconstitutional because I don't.
I can't
remember what happened with it. But what I was saying is that people in inner cities shoot each other with, great regularity.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a major declaration on my part, because you know that I'm not a gun person by any means. I don't want to take your guns. Don't worry. Don't call and freak out. But there is something happened in my neighborhood the other night, and it was frightening enough to me that I was screaming in the phone to my neighbor, I swear to God, I'm getting a gun. That's it. Huh. Then I calmed down the next day. But, geez, there are times when I've even considered it.
Listen, I know a guy who was very surprised. A guy that I just know kind of, through being at the same restaurant. Mm-hmm. And he actually saved people from this armed crazy guy in Holiday Market in Royal Oak.
Really?
Pulled a gun. Yeah, he was carrying and pulled a gun. So you go, oh, that's good.
But when did that happen?
Not so long
ago. That's the nicest market I know.
I know. I mean, well, there's increasingly crazy people all around.
Yeah, for sure. Then the incident that that happened too close for comfort to my house was someone who was mentally unstable.
Yeah. Well, so was this person.
Yeah.
Maybe it was the same person. They let him out.
Maybe.
Something like that.
Oh.
All right. While we talk about guns, while we talk about all these other issues, all of which are important, what's really missing here is what's going to be happening. I said this last week, for the future of our country. There's an election coming up, and as always, most of us see that we have two possibilities. We either can re-elect President Barack Obama, mm-hmm. or we can elect the challenger, Mitt Romney.
Good job.
Mitt Romney.
Are you working on it?
And I don't think that you have to be extraordinarily enthusiastic about Barack Obama. Some people are. And there are a number of accomplishments that have been carried out in his administration. Remember, there was all these wars going on when he took over. There was this Reaganomic Bush depression that he'd created.
Yes.
And people say, well, yeah, you know what? I'm taken back. Remember, I used to say we got a choice between the party that can't fix it and the party that caused it, the Republicans being the party that caused it. I'm going to really take it back, because not only did the Republicans and Reaganomics in this attempt to loot the middle class to the benefit of who the Republicans represent, the ultra-rich, mm-hmm. But they have stood in the way of every attempt on the part of the Democrats to ameliorate the problem, to solve the problem, because they want the president to fail.
Yeah, they absolutely do. And they don't call them the party of no for no reason.
No. Yeah. But the other thing is that most of us have politically, and hence our economic future, the eggs in one basket. Like, that whole thing about hope is that we vote for Barack Obama and we hope he's going to fix everything.
And, anyone who with a half a brain in their head should know that there's no way that he couldn't even do it in 8 years, what they are expecting of this man. There's no way in hell.
Well, yeah, I mean, the problem is pretty intractable, and I don't even know that there is great possibility or great resolve to, in fact, fix it. I mean, we talk about an economy that's only growing by 1.5%, that there was a slight uptick in the unemployment, and you hear a lot of indicators that things are getting better. More jobs have been added, and you got to remember, under Bush, in the last year of Bush, they were losing like 500,000 jobs a month.
At least there are gains.
Yeah, there's like 150,000 jobs gained. I mean, nowhere near
enough. I'm actually surprised it's even that many.
But it's not, it's very possible that none of these jobs are going to come back, or that we could live in a country like there's other countries in the world where unemployment is just a regular 20% or, mm-hmm. and great numbers of the people that are employed are on jobs that don't pay very well.
Right, or without benefits.
And if we just are going to elect, we're going to reelect Barack Obama and hope this time things get better. Well, good luck. I mean, it is just luck. I mean, if you really think that that Mitt Romney is going to get in and is going to create more jobs or solve your problems, or that's really you're in serious dreamland. But so where could this possibly come about that there's anybody that thinks that Where is, I was looking for this one. Oh, yeah. This, that Mitt Romney and the Republicans could help the average person. I mean, it's not like Barack Obama and the Democrats. The Democratic officials and elected leaders are these great stalwarts of the working class and the middle class.
And
because they, too, are tied into the military-industrial complex. They, too, are tied into being financed by the wealthy.
Yeah,
and
they're
all
in
that.
With the corporations.
Yeah. But, you know, they at least know that you got to throw a little our way, to the average person, to the common person. The Republicans have no intent to do that whatsoever. And why there is anyone out there that's making under $200,000 or $300,000 thinks
right.
that they are going to do anything except lose from the Republicans getting in is way beyond me. You could tell us. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan with you at 313-298-WRIF. In fact, I've thrown that out any number of times. Please tell me what plan Mitt Romney has to, quote, get the country moving again.
Fix it all.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And he doesn't care about you. And the one thing that I get about people thinking that, Peter, is that a lot of people are hurting. And they're not doing their research enough, and they're just listening to everyone else bitch about Barack Obama. And they're just going straight to those, you know, talking points.
Well, let's really narrow it down, too. One of the problems is, and this is in an article that is in, where, the Business and Financial News from Reuters, yeah. President Barack Obama made history in his 2008 election victory as the first black U.S. president, but he risks achieving another less welcome first if he wins again in November. Obama is on course to become the candidate with the lowest support from white male working class voters to win a U.S. election if he triumphs over Republican Mitt Romney on November 6th. The majority of whites earning under $50,000 have regularly voted for the Republican. I mean, they're saying that, 4 years ago, white males without college education, that 61% of them voted for John McCain. In other words, they voted for a continuation of Bush Reaganomics, right?
Yeah.
What brought them, particularly the working class and the lower middle class, to the brink of, well, I shouldn't say the brink of disaster, to many of you, to disaster. The continuation of this wars, and who fights that? The working class and the lower middle class. You know, rich guys don't go in the army.
Hell no.
You know, Mitt Romney.
If they do, it's very rare.
Yeah. Mitt was another one of these chicken hawks. He supported the war in Vietnam,
but didn't go.
He's got six sons, and none of them ever went, of course, and I mean, that leaves it up to the grunts, and so, but you can't win an election on representing the 1% if they're the only people that vote, because you would lose 99% to 1%.
Right.
You wouldn't even exist. So what you got to do is you got to get all these wedge issues in there, and particularly a great wedge issue for the Republicans, because all of the racists in the world have drifted to the Republican Party. They used to all be in the Democratic Party up until the
1960s.
Right. They all, up until, really till 1980. When Ronald Reagan says, we will get the white racists from the South out of the Democratic Party and into the Republican Party. And Ronald Reagan began his campaign in the name of the town, in Mississippi, where those four civil rights workers
have
been lynched and murdered and tortured back in the 60s. And this,
I mean, what an insult.
And what a purposeful manipulation.
Yes. Just like Mitt Romney's, all he's doing right now is manipulating people's minds.
Well, let's see here.
His fear-mongering.
So, polls show that support for Obama from white males without college degrees is at under 30%. I mean, I would put it out to you. Does the skin tone of somebody mean more to you than your pocketbook?
Hate to say it.
I mean, let me really be cruel.
I really think people are there.
Let me be cruel. Are you really that dumb?
Are you really that racist, period?
That you don't care about your pocketbook? You don't care about your family?
Yeah.
You don't care about your community?
You don't want those blacks getting into, you know, anything powerful.
And he said, wait a minute. What are you talking about? Republican U.S. presidential challenger Mitt Romney. Here's something again, from the Reuters Business and Financial News. Romney's proposal to slash income taxes by 20% across the board would boost income for the wealthiest taxpayers while reducing it for the middle class. Now, is that clear? Now you say, whoa, this is probably just a bunch of Democrats and a bunch of, commies or something like that. This was put out by the Tax Policy Center, a joint venture between the Brookings Institute and the Urban Institutes, led by Donald Marone, a former economic official in the administration of Republican President George W. Bush.
Ding, ding, ding.
Another one of the study's authors, William Gale, was an economic advisor to Republican President George H.W. Bush. So the deal is, because of the value of the 20% tax cut for the richer Americans would exceed the gains they get from popular tax breaks that Romney might chop, they would see the greatest income gain from Romney's possible changes, it said.
So while trying to make it sound so good for everyone, it's really good for those top dogs.
About two-thirds of the $1.1 trillion in revenues that the government foregoes annually because of tax breaks to the wealthy would have to be curbed to fund Romney's tax cut, and believe it, they're not going to do it.
Right.
So right now there's a whole big thing about Romney taxes. In fact, the head of the Republican Party called the senator from Nevada, Harry Reid, a dirty liar.
Oh, yeah, I know.
They really know how to hurt
they
a guy, don't they?
They are so cruel.
They are. They really And what happened was that the Senate Democratic leader, Harry Reid, said he passed along an anonymous claim that Romney hasn't paid taxes for 10 years, which is why he doesn't want to release his taxes.
I think it should be mandatory.
Well, they are talking about passing a law for this.
Right.
But here's what I think.
What?
I think he probably has paid taxes for the last 10 years. That's not why. Maybe he hasn't. But I would think he'd paid some tax. He pays at a much lower rate than you and I because most of his income and his $250 million fortune comes from capital gains. And you know what that is, right? Everybody doesn't know what that is.
No, they don't.
You and I get income. If we're wage earners, and most of the people don't own small businesses, so forget about that for now. But when you have investments, the income derived from your investments is taxed at a much, much lower rate than income. Mm-hmm. So they're getting like a 15% tax on millions and millions and millions. What did he get, like $23 million?
Yeah, and we're paying 30% on paychecks, right?
And so the Republicans are getting hysterical, saying, he's a dirty liar and he's making things up to divert the campaign away from the real issues.
Yeah, look in the mirror.
Well, the real issue is how the 1% rules all the rest of us and has so wrecked the economy under the rubric of Reaganomics, administered to the max by George W. Bush. Remember George W. Bush?
Yeah.
Anybody heard about him?
He's in hiding.
Anybody seen him?
He's clearing the brush.
He's not even invited
to the Republican National Convention.
Right. They don't want to.
You know, you just stay there on your ranch.
Because if anybody associates us with George W. Bush and the Bush recession depression with the wars that he started.
Yeah, they might figure it out. Yeah. We call that connecting the dots on this show.
Absolutely. Well, here's what I think. I think I even wrote it down. Did I? Yeah. We'll find out if he releases all of that. Wait a minute here. Repeating the call by Democrats and many Republicans, the senator from New York, Chuck Schumer, said, guess what? Few things we know about Mitt Romney's taxes. Cayman Islands, Swiss bank accounts raise more questions than they answer. He should rip the Band-Aid off now. He should have done it 2 years ago. Yeah. No one could understand why. At a campaign event in Denver on Thursday, Romney called the attack baloney.
Oh, God.
That is some
baloney.
Like...
baloney.
That's some like... Like 40s, 1940s or something. That's a lot of baloney. Now, what I started to say, I think what if these taxes would be released... Well, there's a couple of things. One, not releasing them is really hurting him. And people are...
sure.
This is creating his image that he is a guy
it's becoming...
Got,
and it is an issue, just right. like all the other issues.
Because people want to know what kind of, how is he connected?
Yeah, just tell us, dude. Yeah. We know you're loaded.
Well, there's a couple of things. Either they'll find out that his tax rate is so low that it'll look bad, or yeah. that he has so much stashed in Swiss
that
bank accounts in the Cayman Islands.
Either way, it's going to look bad, Peter.
Yeah, but he says and Romney says he wants to know what Harry Reid's sources are. He says, time for Harry to put up or shut up. Doesn't that sound more like it should be addressed to Romney? But in any event, probably not releasing him would hurt him less. As much as they're hurting him, would hurt him less than releasing him.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of like the whole drug issue. At least Clinton and Obama admitted their stuff. You know, they got it out of the way.
Yeah, absolutely. There's an article I thought was interesting, too, from the Atlantic magazine, and it says how the rich have gotten richer at the expense of the rest of us, right? I mean, it doesn't come out of nowhere. I mean, wealth is created, but then it's how is it distributed? Well, what's happening in this country, and it has been happening for the last 20 or 30 years, that all the wealth, the vast majority of wealth goes to the high side, to the 1%, and a lot less, in some cases less than less, go to people below the 1%. So in 1992, the 400th richest person in America made $24 million. In 2007, the 400th richest person in America made $87 million with inflation adjusted. Actually, they made $138 million, but, you know, and adjusted for inflation dollars. So there, in what would that be, 25 years, the rich have increased their wealth by four times. In that same period, mostly middle class and working class wages have remained constant or
they've gone backwards.
Yeah. And the number of people that are poor has increased as well. The average income of a top 400 earner grew by 650% between 1992 and 2007. Mm. Over that time, the average salary didn't even double. But then again, that's inflation dollars. But the average capital gains haul increased by 1,200%.
Wow.
So how do the richest get richer? Not from wages, but from their investments. So, and the investments, I don't know, and this is another thing that probably went right by the wayside. You know what? How about let's do this? Rather than this could take me off a bit as well. There's a couple of you already waiting to talk. I'd like to hear from you. 313-298-WRIF.
And we do have a couple of open lines. It's 313-298-9743.
And the stock market last week almost crashed again, leading one person to say the machines have taken over.
Mm.
Right?
You're listening to Nightfall with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Do you need cash right now for any reason? Then you need Matt's Jewelry Brokers. At Matt's, they pay top dollar for your used or broken gold, silver, and platinum jewelry, class rings, belt buckles, coins, flatware, and more. It's really that easy. Stop into one of Matt's five locations with your items and walk out with cold, hard cash.
Hi, I'm Matt. We've been family-owned and operated for 30 years and pride ourselves on honesty, integrity, and paying more than the superstores do for your broken or used items just lying around the house. If it's collecting dust, we'll buy it. If it's broken, we'll buy it. If you don't want it, we'll buy it. So before you go anywhere else, stop by one of my five locations. In Macomb at 21 Mile and Romeo Plank, in Troy at Square Lake and Rochester Road, or my pawn shop in Southfield at 10 Mile and Greenfield. We're also in the Meyer in Clinton Township and Lennox. Check us out online at MattsJewelryBrokers.com or call us at 586-286-2866. That's 586-286-2866. When you need cash fast, go to Matt's.
Get swimsuit ready and reveal your true shape. Discover Cellulize. Hi, I'm Dr. Michael Gray. A new technique that breaks up cellulite and fat directly underneath the top layers of the skin. Once cellulite fibers are destroyed, the skin looks smoother. Cellulite is no longer a reason to stay out of the swimsuit this summer. Summer 2012, reveal your true self cellulite-free. It's possible. It's Cellulize.
Call 248-538-3333 or anewyou.com.
Call me today, and I'll see you tomorrow. Nationwide, most women prefer scarless breast augmentation. I am Dr. Michael Gray, and I've been performing this scarless procedure for over 20 years now. It is still the number one choice among women choosing breast augmentation. Visit anewyou.com to see before and after photos of my scarless procedure. Schedule your complimentary consultation to learn why scarless breast augmentation could be right for you.
Call 248-538-3333.
I am Dr. Michael Gray. Call me today, and I will see you tomorrow.
You know that friend who's always coming up with the next big thing? Like pasta for cats. Yeah, him. If he tells you about a great idea for an online car insurance company that's built to save people money, tell him Esurance has been doing that since pretty much forever. But his idea to start a brotel, the fraternity-style hotel, is awesome. Not like insurance of the modern world awesome, but good. Esurance. Now backed by Allstate. Click or call.
Visit Esurance.com or call 1-800-ESURANCE for a quote. Not available in all states. Savings may vary.
Hey, this is Mike Rowe talking with Jim Twitchell, a real live Ford senior master technician. Can the work save me money on gas, yes or no?
Yes. By making sure that your car is in optimal running condition, you save yourself fuel.
Save money on gas with the works. $29.95 or less after $10 mail-in rebate. Click on the banner ad now.
Can you think of one good reason why somebody wouldn't bring their Ford to you for the works fuel saver package?
Honestly, Mike, no.
Up to 5 quarts oil, taxes, diesel, and disposal fees extra. Claim based on EPA averages. See your participating Ford dealer for rebate details through 8/31/12.
with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much. And we're talking about Mitt Romney's tax problem. This guy will not release his 10 years of taxes. And we really think that either it's going to show he's paid no taxes, extraordinarily low taxes, mm-hmm. or that he's got all his money just squirreled away in these tax
safe
havens.
Little places.
Yeah, yeah. And the other thing, very concerning, that now under 30% of white males without college degrees are backing Mitt Romney, which is not too much below how many voted for John McCain, 61% in 2008.
That's false hope right there.
And these are men that are cutting their own throat, cutting their families' throats, cutting their communities' throats. I mean, can you imagine being anybody other than a right-wing whack job that can go through 8 years of Bush with wars based on lies, mm-hmm. body counts, you know, rising, the economy tanking, all because of the policies of this man. So this was a referendum, and also of sinking wages, of more offshoring by people like Mitt Romney, of American jobs, and all of that. And these guys say, well, you know, what? I don't even know what they say. You know, Obama's a gun grabber. I don't even know if they said that back then.
I mean, guys,
come on, is anybody going to call 313-298-WRIF and give some policy reason? You know what will happen again? It'll be some of you that actually have some capacity to put one word after another and say why. But those of you who are just voting because of some twisted emotion that you don't want to vote for a Democrat, or you don't, worse, you don't want to vote for a black Democrat, get a grip on yourself, man.
Yeah, really.
You're cutting
breath.
Your throat. You know, speaking of that, my old friend Ed from St. Clair Shores, who's all, I love this guy because he's always telling me I'm not radical enough.
And for those of you who are rolling your eyes right now, I feel you.
And Ed writes on our Facebook page. You can go to Facebook, facebook.com/nightcall. And hey, like us as well. Get in on it. Yeah. He says, so you're going to endorse Jill Stein tonight, right? And Jill Stein is the Green Party presidential candidate. And Jill Stein is a dream candidate. Everything that she wants, everything that the Green Party wants, is what has the possibility to bring peace.
To make it a better world.
Environmentally sound. Yeah. To have economies that are based on something other than the military-industrial complex and all of that. So why aren't I endorsing Jill Stein? You know what? I'm not endorsing Barack Obama. I'll probably vote for him. I never used to vote for the Democrats at all. But I wonder, Ed, and you write me frequently, feel free to call in at 313-298-WRIF. Mm-hmm. And it's the old trap that to vote for Jill Stein takes a vote away from Barack Obama. The social critic and great linguist Noam Chomsky says, of course I'll vote for the lesser of the two evils. Isn't it better to have the lesser than the greater? And so, I mean, I think that the Green Party really needs a presence here like it does in Europe, and it needs to start winning local offices.
Yeah.
And at some point needs to overtake the Democratic Party. And so you would have a realignment of parties, and the Republican Party can stay as its far right-wing proto-fascist direction it's going, and a Green Party could be the Social Democratic Party of the United States, for sure. Right now, I don't know. I mean, I know that Mitt Romney is not going to win or lose Michigan by one vote. So, anyway. But so there's the tax deal, and you can comment. I mean, how do we deal with this third party thing? I mean, do we hold our nose and vote for a candidate that doesn't meet up completely with our expectations or what we want in a candidate?
How could one candidate stand up to all of our expectations?
That's they might be able to.
I don't know, Peter.
I mean, you think if Jill Stein got in, all of a sudden she'd start saying, hey, buddy, can we make a deal?
No, I guess not.
Not because it would be a whole different
everything.
Because it would be a whole different set of affairs. It would mean that that no longer big money was financing elections. It would mean that that people would actually, for once in American history, be in charge rather than, you know, rich elites. By the way, I want to say one more thing, and then I want to get to the phones. One more. By the way, the other thing is that the Romney tax plan helps rich, hurts middle class, according to the Tax Policy Center that is run by Republicans, a former official in the administration of George Bush and another one, an economic advisor to George H.W. Bush. So this is no lefty thing. That it would that the Romney tax plan is going to give the rich more money and give ordinary people less. So if you vote for him, you're just saying, here, I'd like to turn over some of my money to the rich people.
Yes.
More of your money.
Please, beat me down a little more.
Yeah, and I was thinking about one thing about...
I don't care if I eat.
Remember what I've said probably 10 times on this show? I would like some conservative to tell me when conservatives, any time in American history, have been on the right side of a social and political question. That is, remember, and I always run this off
of the people.
Yeah.
Really?
Well, you know, the conservatives wanted to stay a colony of Britain. They wanted to maintain slavery and just all the way down the line. The only thing is that there is no conservative today that would say, oh, yes, we should have remained a colony. There's no conservative that...
Slavery was good.
Yeah. There's no that says segregation was good. They were. I mean, they were on the wrong side of the union movement, of course, and they were... But I would... And there are a number... Well, actually, it's not true what I'm saying, you know, because during the 1930s, the conservatives opposed the minimum wage, didn't want a minimum wage at all. Mm-hmm. They didn't want Social Security.
No, they wanted a minimum wage.
With the way it was. They didn't want Medicare, which, by the way, it's the 47th anniversary of Medicare.
Oh.
Socialized medicine.
Hey, ooh.
For those over 65.
Peter, you said the S word.
Yeah. So I just would, again, put out the challenge to name one political question in this country in which conservatives were correct.
Okay. They, good luck.
Yeah. All right.
So, and...
yeah.
Go.
And now, and we, this is, actually, this is great because this is an old friend, from talk show days. And it's somebody who used to call Jalene and I when we were doing a nationally syndicated show back in the early 2000s. Chris now in Taos, New Mexico. Chris, you're up there looking for crystals.
Oh, well, no, actually, I'm just sort of kicking back looking for rocks.
Rocks.
He actually does amazing art with rocks. Hi.
Hi.
It's good to talk to you again, Jolene, you gorgeous creature. You.
Hello.
Chris, I'm here.
Wait,
I'm here too.
Wait, what about my brain? What about my brain?
Your brain is gorgeous and dusky spoken too.
Ooh, I like it.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Enough about me. What do you want to talk about?
I have been watching American politics, and American presidential politics in particular, for decades, and I have never seen anything like this. I really think that Mitt Romney would rather lose the election than reveal what's in those tax returns.
Oh, my.
Which tells you that whatever's in there must be really stinky poison. You know, everybody's speculating, and the thing is that him not releasing leaves the rest of us open to speculate, like Harry Reid. You know, now we have Reince Priebus and Lindsey Graham going on the Sunday talk show shows calling him a liar, when it would be very simple to prove him a liar. Just have Mitt release his tax returns, but he won't.
Well, you know, Chris, look at it this way. When these tapes hopefully that people remember this history, there were these tapes from the Nixon White House, which were so amazing because the guy's being taped and he's saying the most awful things. But he had a secretary named Rosemary Woods, and she deleted 14 minutes of it. And people were saying, how in the world could she do anything that bad to, you know, to attempt to protect her criminal boss, you know, Nixon, and someone said there was only one thing worse, and this is what you're saying about the taxes. I think there's only one thing worse than not having erased what was on that tape, and was to allow that tape to come out. Mm. And the same thing you said, Romney would rather lose
than have that info come out.
You know what? It's very possible that if he does release it, he would lose it, eh?
Well, no, obviously. Obviously, what is in the returns is far more onerous than taking the hits he's taking every day now.
That's what I mean.
The problem, you know, what I personally think it is that in 2009, Mitt Romney took a tax amnesty, which was offered, which means he committed a felony and was amnestied for that felony, which means he wouldn't be able to run for the presidency. You know, what this basically comes down to is that the only way that the circumstance can be cleared up is if Mitt Romney will release his tax returns, and he simply won't. And so the man is not, if you look at the electoral map, he is way behind. Now, if you pay attention to the mainstream media, of course, they want a horse race. They want everything neck and neck because they can sell more advertising.
Sure, they keep you watching. But, you know, actually, Chris, the polls do show that if the election was held today, Barack Obama would win. He's got the big states, you know, that Mitt Romney can win, you know, Nevada and Utah and, I don't know, Montana and Idaho and stuff like that, but it doesn't matter. It's Pennsylvania, it's Michigan. That's why, for instance, as I was saying earlier about when I was saying that Barack Obama has such a low support among white males without college degrees, is that the AFL-CIO is going to have 400,000 volunteers in this cycle. That's 150,000 more. And actually, they are going to be in Nevada, but the union's main focus will be in six states: Pennsylvania, Ohio, Nevada, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Florida, where the polls show that the presidential race is close. But most of them show Obama up on it. And the electoral poll now shows it's Obama reelected. Yeah.
Let's say goodbye.
Okay.
Hey, Chris.
Chris, thank you very much.
Great to talk to you.
Thank you, guys.
All right. Yeah, man. We, did you go to, when we
were, go way back.
Yeah, we do. When we would go out to Santa Fe to broadcast, did you go up to Taos with me?
I did not go to Taos with you.
I know my wife did.
I don't know why
one
I didn't.
Time. We had
a
grand
time. I think I was
time.
Too busy enjoying different parts of Santa Fe, like the margaritas. In fact, I recall you hunting around town and finding me one night, and I was absolutely amazed you found me.
Yeah, and our general manager.
Yeah. And hey, at least I was with the boss.
And then I was also a keynote speaker at a meeting of the Santa Fe, or even was it the New Mexico NAACP, right?
I don't remember that.
Well, I don't think you were there. And I spoke, and I looked out at this, like, and, you know, it's a very white state. There's, you know, Native Americans and Mexican Americans and all that. And other than the hosts, who are African-American, so I looked out and I say, it's, you know, I'm just so proud to be able to speak to the NAACP, but I said, where are the CPs? and the white audience kind of looked horrified.
Oh, my God.
And my two hosts.
They thought it was good.
They fell out
well,
laughing.
Well, good.
Yeah. All right. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Sorry to take your job away
Peter,
there.
By all means.
Yes, at 1 a.m., a couple of very interesting interviews. One about how the CIA engineered the killing of Che Guevara. You know, the Che you always see on the T-shirts.
Yeah, the kids are here. Into Che.
Yeah, and also another one about a Detroit plant closing. You know, this is interesting.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Let's do some more calls, huh?
Yeah, we're only 50 minutes into the show, and we've taken one call.
That's right.
Get on it, Peter.
Here is Daryl. Daryl's in Romulus. Hey, Daryl, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, Peter. Hey,
Hi.
Julie.
Hello.
I like you guys every night. I like the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I do not want Romney in office because he's the biggest crook there ever was.
He's a crook.
I don't know if he's the biggest.
He's up there. I mean, there's that Madoff guy, and, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you what, I wish to God that we could get back Bill Clinton back in the office. Because when he was president, there was more jobs and help wanted everywhere. The employers were crying.
Yeah. Even my Republican father was happy.
You know, also, we have to remember that when Bill Clinton left office, there was a budget surplus.
There was.
Bring in George Bush, and you start
the right out of there.
Yeah, you cut the taxes for the wealthy. You bring in Reaganomics that destroys, that creates this housing bubble and this stock bubble. And
but hey, the folks in the military-industrial complex are happy as hell.
Yeah.
I haven't worked since December, and I'm hoping to go back to work here in the next couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
I've been out of work.
Wow.
Daryl, let me ask you a question. You know, I know a little about Romulus, and I think it's, I think it's an integrated city, but it's mostly white. When you talk, we were talking about 61% of white males without college degrees voting for the Republican in the last election, and even less planning to vote for Obama this time and to vote for Romney. Do you run into guys like this that say, I'm voting for Romney, or I'm not voting for Obama?
No, I haven't. Lucky,
okay,
I haven't.
Good.
There goes that, but good.
Yeah, that's good.
Because everybody that I've talked to, because I'm union, I'm a union worker, everybody I talk to is voting for Obama.
Oh, well, we're glad to hear that.
Well, yeah, but you know what?
Because Mitt Romney doesn't care at all about unions.
We know a lot of folks in the UAW, including the president, Bob King.
We've known a few presidents.
Yes, actually, we have a few presidents of the UAW, but one who hired us.
One who hired and one who fired.
Well, that's another story. But anyway, so they'll say, yeah, like 30% of our members vote for the Republicans. And it occurs to me that one of the major goals of the Republican Party is the destruction of every union in the United States. So why would, I mean, even if there was a gun thing, abortion thing, what have you.
Gay thing, gay marriage thing,
whatever.
Healthcare thing.
Yeah. I mean, isn't number one your economic survival and the economic survival of your family and of your community.
And your future.
Yeah, so I don't get it. I don't get it.
Because the ones that are wanting to vote Republican for Romney, they don't understand the whole picture of what he's out to do.
Right. They just think they've been looking at or listening to those talking points and saying, oh, wait, this isn't working, so we've got to go here. Really.
Yeah, I don't know. I still think it's a little deeper. I think that I think a lot of
I think there's a lot of racism.
A lot of racism, but you know, they never for probably 30 years, white males making under 50,000 have voted for the Republicans, majority of them.
Yeah.
You know, so that means Kerry, and that means Gore.
Well, especially when you look back. Further back when race was even more of an issue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, thank you very much, Daryl. I appreciate
it. Sadly, still an issue.
Let's see here. Let me see. What kind of time we got? Time.
People still want his birth certificate, which he's provided.
Yeah.
God.
Here's Fred in Detroit. Fred, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Okay, you got a long list of topics to get to, but
we always do.
And a short amount of time.
Yeah, we're actually up against a break, so go ahead.
Okay, well, I just wanted to say that, you know, people have to remember that the market is rigged, and that the documentaries on the crash of 29 explained how, and nowadays it's about insider information, you know, and that's why capital gains should be taxed heavier. And these people that want to buy and sell stocks, you know, for pennies on a trade and sell them every 5 or 10 minutes, they should be taxed heavier.
Yeah.
Well, let me
the whole crapshoot.
Yeah.
That you're talking
let
about,
me
yeah.
tell people again. Capital gains and what Fred is talking about is very important. That is income from investments. The idea was that if you would give people that were going to risk investments, that they should get rewarded a little more, and that would also encourage them to create more businesses, hence more jobs and what have you. And all it's done, and particularly since it's gone lower and lower, some of it went lower under Clinton, but it really hit rock bottom at 15% under George W. Bush. And you know, I've learned in talks show school that you're supposed to do a little teaser before going into your next segment. And I said I was going to tell you about how the machines have taken over, and I forgot completely about that. But let me, Fred, give me 1 minute more worth of talk, and I got to go.
Well, I was just going to add that, you know, as far as these guys that want to keep voting Republican, you have all these talking heads from, I mean, actual think tank thinkers who are conservative and saying that the Republican philosophy is all wrong for the economy today. They're coming out against what the Congress and Romney wants to do because it's not logical for the economy.
No, if what Romney promises he's going to do, it will totally crash the economy. All right, thank you very much, Fred. As usual, 313-298-WRIF.
And you're not just saying that. You know, I mean, I'm saying.
What?
About crashing the economy.
Oh, no.
You're not making things up like he does.
No, the system of capitalism is such a house of cards. It is so fragile at this point, and particularly because it's been internationalized and it's become not mechanized, beyond that, you know, technologized. In fact, I will. Make me do this when I come back.
I like
this
making
story,
it. What?
This story.
Okay. You're doing it.
All right. Right back to you.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Hey, this is Mike Rowe talking with Jim Twitchell, a real live Ford senior master technician. Can the work save me money on gas, yes or no?
Yes. By making sure that your car is in optimal running condition, you save yourself fuel.
Save money on gas with the works. $29.95 or less after $10 mail-in rebate. Click on the banner ad now.
Can you think of one good reason why somebody wouldn't bring their Ford to you for the works fuel saver package?
Honestly, Mike, no.
Up to 5 quarts oil, taxes, diesel, and disposal fees extra. Claim based on EPA averages. See your participating Ford dealer for rebate details through 8/31/12.
Rockin' Detroit at 101.1 FM and the rest of the planet online at WRIF.com.
Whose house is it? Whose house? Whose house?
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Oh, yes!
Okay.
The Riff.
Peter and Jolene, you're listening to Night Call, the Riff's award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our second hour. Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan, ready to take your calls at 313-298-WRIF. And we're talking about Mitt Romney's tax problem. And the reason that it is he's got to convince people that he's just not some rich SOB that's going to act only on behalf of the 1% of which he is, of course.
And when you say tax problem, what we're talking about, especially if you just tuned in and or don't know what we're talking about, he will not release his
tax returns. Yeah. And everyone is urging, including Republicans, and we think that probably it will be so bad either. On $21.6 million last year, or 2010, he paid 13.9%. And it says in this article here, most of Romney's income came from investment gains, which are taxed at a lower rate than earned income.
Yeah, so then all the rest of us, we're paying 30%, he's paying 15%.
Well, what happened last week was an automated stock trading program suddenly flooded the market with millions of trades Wednesday morning, spreading turmoil across Wall Street and drawing renewed attention to the fragility and instability of the nation's stock markets. Now, think about this. I mean, this probably sounded like some ordinary news
like
item.
Like the part of the news that you tune out of.
Yeah, like, oh, wow. Yeah.
Well, like, blah, 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 blah.
At a job, and you're concerned with keeping your job or finding a job, or if you're, like, in your teens and or in college and you're worried about, are you going to be able to get a job and pay off your student loan? And an automated stock trading program. Well, here, right, what happened was that, let me see if this gets right to it. Traders on Wednesday said that a rogue algorithm repeatedly bought and sold millions of shares of companies like Radio Shack, Best Buy, Bank of America, and American Airlines, sending trading volume surging, while the trading firm involved blamed a technology issue. By the way, they've lost almost $500 million. I'm not quite sure what that means. I mean, lost? Did somebody else get it? Or?
Well, it's all kind of up in, it's all air anyway.
Yeah, it is.
Really.
I mean, this is not real value, folks. Right. This is, and that's what's really wrong. That's, I mean, it's a chimera?
A crapshoot.
Yeah. I mean, it's not, there's no there really there. I probably shouldn't say that because once it's like the emperor has no clothes.
Yeah.
And if everyone realized that, this would really send everything down the drain. So what's happening is all these stocks are bought and sold by machines, not like these people going, oh, 16, you know, you always see, but rather just. And
computer.
So Patrick Healy, the chief executive of the Issuer Advisory Group, a capital markets consulting firm, said the machines have taken over, right? I mean, isn't this a little like Terminator?
Yeah, it's very.
And they're going to get rid of us. But here, most importantly, he said, when events like this happen, they just reaffirm these aren't investors, these are traders. T-R-A-D-E-R-S.
Right.
Traitors, not traitors.
Right.
Traitors. So what? You going, yeah, so what? You know, what does that mean to me? I'm just, you know.
I just want to get a job and pay my bills.
When events like this happen, in other words, this rogue algorithm took over and sold millions of shares of stock in these companies, that that they reaffirm that these aren't investors. Now, the idea of stock investments was that you and I would, well, let's say, Jolene and I would say, hey, here's a company that is going to sell Mexican salsa, right? And somebody comes to us and says, well, gee, I got this great salsa. Everybody says, great, and I got the marketing scheme, but I don't have enough money. Can you guys give me $1,000 a piece, and you invest in the firm, you'll become partial owner, and you'll get so-and-so return on your investment. Mm-hmm. They're investors. But what all is going on here
They're actually investing in something concrete,
a
product.
Yeah, what we would do. What we would do.
Right.
But these guys, and they're not even guys. They're machines. That's our fate, the fate of the economy. Because one slip like this, boom, it all goes down the drain. Mm-hmm. And why? I mean, because, because this is not a system that has human beings at the center of it. And increasingly now, the capital is this, you know, non-human form that has done enormous damage to people and to the planet over the ages. I mean, it's helped a lot of people live a materially good life. Mm-hmm. But if you really added it up, what was necessary to create this? I mean, the original capital accumulation, wealth accumulation in the United States was primarily based on slave labor. So it necessitated the slave system in order to create the beginnings of a wealthy country. I mean, people don't like to look at it. People were made to work in factories, 12 and 14 hours a day, destroyed millions of lives throughout probably 100 years or more, maybe 150 years, working under the most awful conditions imaginable. In fact, like sometime in the 1840s, you had slave labor in the South, and grotesque so-called free labor, industrial labor in the North, you know, that was beginning to compete, you know, with the slave wealth. So it ain't a pretty picture, folks. And as long as we are going to cede the field, that is to give up all the decisions to the people that rule things and rule us, the rulers, in other words, it's going to keep going on like this, and we're going to be stuck with hope.
We will stay the peasants we are.
Yeah, thatch our roofs.
Yes.
Or revolt.
Mm-hmm.
Peasants.
Revolt!
All right, let's see. Everybody, someone's been, Kirby's been waiting a long time. Kirby's in Trenton. Kirby, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing, Peter? Julian?
We're good.
Like to talk about a comment you made earlier about middle class white guys voting Republican when they really shouldn't be.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm one of them guys and union guy, and there's 35 of us at the I'm a terminal, and I tell you what, man, there's like five that are liberal and Democrat that absolutely will vote Democratic, and it's just unbelievable.
And this is a union job?
Yes.
Can you?
And you're not one of the five, is what you're telling me.
Absolutely not.
Okay, good.
So what do these guys say?
We'll keep you on the air. Just kidding.
What do these guys say? What do they say?
It's just.
Are they racist?
Millennial? Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I'm not going to go that far, but it's just the reasons are just unbelievable. It's it's the abortion, women's rights, or gun control.
Yeah, they don't want us to have any rights. I get it. They just want to control my.
But Kirby, let me ask you this. I mean, do you ever say to them, don't you know that these guys wanted to, part of their strategy is destroy the union? You got to remember there's two reasons that the Republicans want to destroy unions. One, of course, is a big favor to the big owners that can get our labor cheaper, much, 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 much cheaper if there's no union setting the standard. And the other thing is that unions are one of the bases of the Democratic Party. So it's like they have a double target on all union people's backs, but on everyone's back, because as union wages rose, that was also, they pulled upwards wages for all people, including the minimum wage. So do you ever say that to them? You're going to vote for people that want to destroy our union?
I got to work with these guys, and some of these guys are, they're okay. I've learned a little while ago not to kind of stay out of the political arguments at work.
That's probably a good idea.
No, I don't think so.
We do it because we get paid to do it.
No,
engage us in conversation.
But we front off these morons here.
You're right, we do.
We front off these morons. May hope some of them are listening that... that are going to vote Republican.
I get kind of like a little nudge in the side, or a little tongue in cheek, but serious. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's like, deep down they're not joking.
But Kirby, you could just say next time someone says, "Well, Obama, blah, blah," you say, Well, don't you think the Republicans want to destroy our union? I mean, you could ask them as a question, just like that. Or you could say, you know, I hear what you're saying, but I'm worried that given the opposition that the Republicans have to unions, that they're going to
hurt us.
They're going to hurt us. Huh?
A lot of these guys are anti-union, but enjoy pro-union wages.
Well, that's the most stupid thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, they are. I don't know. Yeah.
These guys. I'm sorry you have to work around these idiots.
All right, Kirby. Thank you very much.
Yes. Don't. Well, I don't know. These guys sound like they're hopeless.
Hey, by the way, this July 24th was the anniversary of the last federal minimum wage increase that went to $7.25.
How long ago was that? What,
3 years.
Okay.
And let's see. Where did it?
So nothing in 3 years, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Legal wars.
Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa and Representative George Miller of California, surprisingly, both Democrats have proposed raising the minimum wage to $9.80.
Tom Harkin.
Yeah. And if you're making $7.25 an hour, you're making $15,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
Can't do much on that.
And you're, you know, probably working your butt off.
Oh, by the way, too, I said earlier about socialized medicine. This is the 47th anniversary of Medicare. And remember that with the Republicans they opposed that as well. Said it was socialized medicine, which it is. And
that's why your grandma is able to
get medical care.
Yes.
Or
you.
Maybe if you're under 40 or even under 50. That, you got to go read history books for that. Everybody was really worried about socialism. And so when you called something socialized medicine, it raised the specter of communism and the Soviet Union and all that.
Mm.
But essentially what it means, we've talked about this before, that cost that can't be borne by an individual or small groups of individuals is socialized throughout the entire society. And as the best example, the fire department. Right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's socialized. That's socialized.
Kind of need that, right?
Yeah, the government pays for it. We pay taxes. Part of the money that we we pay in taxes goes for fire and police and, you know, numerous other
Medicare
things.
Is more important than ever now because people who have worked their entire lives are having their pensions slashed and so many things slashed from these benefits that they thought that they were going to have and not have to worry about at the end of their lives.
Sure. And I was reading somewhere about, this is Steffi Woodhandler. It's an odd last name, Woodhandler. I interviewed her a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
She said, we celebrate Medicare, which along with Social Security has lifted millions of Americans elderly out of poverty.
Yeah.
And you got to remember, there's Republicans still, these libertarian idiots that want to get rid of it. Everybody, why should I pay for them? Everybody should pack their own parachute.
Yeah, and when your mama is dying and can't get her pay for her medicine or for whatever disease she has, you'll sing a different tune.
One of the things, I never got to my conclusion either. My fault. I set it off on something else. I was talking about capital gains, that this is investment income that's taxed at a lower rate than what we may make just going to work every day. And, it is. It's taxed at 15%. The idea is that that this money should be, that the low tax rate should be an inducement to investment. Of course, it's not at all. And so this is a reason why there should be no capital gains tax any differently than any other income. It should be taxed as income. Start off at, some of these guys ought to be taxed at 90% after it gets over a certain level, say 4 or 5 million. Okay, let's
go
back.
There you go again, Peter.
Yeah. Here's Michael in Fenton. Michael, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Maybe we should just get a dictator and just take all their money.
well, no. They tried. They did that, like in Russia and Cuba and China and all that. I mean, that's one way to deal with the maldistribution of income. You know what the Marxists call the dictatorship of the proletariat. But, of course, what happens is it becomes the dictatorship of the party, and it becomes, totally undemocratic, which is not what we need.
Well, I got to give you a lot of credit, Peter. You're pretty sharp. that. But when you were in Santa Fe, I think Julene was over there in Roswell, probably looking for our leaders.
Oh yeah. Well, Roswell in the form of margaritas.
Yeah.
Okay, but you know, I like to talk about Romney, but you know, all that what you were talking about. One thing comes to mind is what's his name? Gosh, Al Gore. He had the popular vote, and they got him. They got Bush in with the electoral. We're not going to see Obama get in. They're going to electoral vote this guy in.
Well, I don't think that's the case. You got to remember, in 2000. The majority of American people voted for Al Gore, and they wanted a continuation of the Clinton years. And not through the Electoral College, although that's ultimately what did it, but essentially the election was outright stolen in Florida in 2000 and outright stolen in Ohio in 2004. So the Democrats always have to get a large majority in order to get through the Republican electoral shenanigans.
We got a bigger problem than that.
We do.
I got a friend that lives over there in Jerusalem. We got a problem what she was telling me about. And the other problem we got is with Romney is he's got the same disease that George Bush had. They're going to do nothing but help their friends, and so we already know what's going to happen when they get in. And I don't even I don't trust none of these guys, but my friend over there in Jerusalem, she tells me that she lives over there. She says that they can't trust the American government, that they're telling us different stories over here, and that they got their backs against the wall, and they got to do something real quick. And she said it looks like we're going to have to attack Damascus and probably nuke Damascus right now because something's got to happen now. They can't keep playing around.
Well, I think you probably mean Tehran. Damascus is in Syria, but the whole area is so volatile. Again, terrible policies all around in that region. All right, Michael, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Thank you for joining
us.
And
anyone who thinks Obama is anti-Israel has lost their marbles.
Yes, I definitely.
There's an old saying for you, just like
lost
baloney.
that's what Mitt Romney said when they charged that he was hiding something because he won't release his taxes.
That's
said,
baloney.
Baloney. Did you see what his aide said at this Polish holy site?
Oh,
to
yeah.
Kiss my ass.
He did it. I mean, unreal.
Yeah, that's what...
nice answer.
Yeah, this is where I'm. That's here somewhere. It's probably, but it's probably not even worth going. But a Romney aide, because he doesn't answer a lot of questions from the press. And in fact, one of the things about the taxes, he says, why he says he doesn't want to reduce
his
tax?
Yeah, what was it?
Oh, he says because people will distort their content.
Right. Sure, dude. Okay.
Got to love it.
Keep going.
Here's Greg.
Blowing smoke.
Here's Greg in Parma, Ohio. Hey, Greg,
yes,
you're on
sir.
The air. What?
Yeah, you got me.
Hello.
In Parma, Ohio?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Isn't the ghoul? Isn't that where the ghoul is from?
No. Well, actually, I'm Parma, Michigan.
Oh, okay. You thought I said Ohio.
Well, you did say Ohio.
Oh, I did. Okay.
No, right. I've been on the line for a while.
Yeah, probably delirious. Yeah, what's going on?
That's enough to drive you to drink.
Well, yeah, if you want to drink, I guess you do.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's up?
Well, I just want to let you know, Barack Obama, nobody gives him any credit. Everybody says that Barack Obama took down our whole economy.
A lot of people are saying that, right? Not everybody.
Really? But. I don't think anybody
you can keep playing with me in my ear.
that sounds kind of kinky.
Look, Greg, I saw some polls recently. We broadcasted a few weeks ago, and it was the majority of people understand that it was George Bush under George Bush's watch. I mean, it began in 2007, 2008 when George Bush was still the president. And, you know, it's not just a matter of on that day, just like it wasn't, you know, Black Friday of 1929. It was the policies of the Republicans during the 1920s, and it was also the policies of the Republicans beginning with Reaganomics.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately carried out with some of the acquiescence of George Clinton. No, of Bill Clinton.
George.
I like George Clinton better.
Absolutely.
All right. Greg in Parma, Michigan,
yeah,
thank
people
you very
are,
much.
People are down on him. You're right about that.
Yeah. Yeah. Some.
Some people are very down on him.
Do you know, remember the Ghoul?
I do.
Remember what his theme song was?
No.
Power to the People by John Lennon.
No way.
Yeah, wasn't it?
Look, no. Was it really?
Come on, someone give us an email.
Someone. If you're wrong about this.
Call talkyes at yahoo.com.
Are we copying the Ghoul?
Yeah, because we have that on our... Introduction. Let me see here. I'll even just, how do we do this? Oh, yeah. Let me see. Okay. We can. That's the Beatles.
That's the one that's two and the four, not the one and the three.
No. Revolution starts.
You know, who's that? The Revolution Starts.
I don't know.
That's the singer-songwriter. You know,
John Earl?
No,
Steve Earl.
Yeah.
Hey, look, I do.
You do. Yeah.
But even though I got his name wrong.
All right. Les, where's our next caller? It is here. It's Tony. Hi, Tony. You're on the air. Where are you calling from?
Hi, Romulus. How you doing?
Hi, Tony.
Hi.
I think the biggest problem right now is, the high level of unemployment that we have.
It's a problem. Jobs are being gained again, once again.
And just about everything you buy, it says right there on the package, is either made in Mexico or China. So,
yeah, that's true.
So what you had there was like a shift of the entire American manufacturing base.
Well, there's so little. I mean, really, there's so very little anymore.
But what was the original impetus or agreement that allowed this to happen? I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, it was the NAFTA agreement and the most favored nation status given unto China, and these both were signed under the
Clinton administration.
Yep.
Yeah, sure. I mean, they were Republican bills. I mean, that's what happened. The majority of Democrats, in many ways, Bill Clinton was a good moderate Republican, which is still pretty far right. I mean, Bill Clinton, if he was in Europe, would be a center rightist, not a center leftist, but a center rightist. And the majority of Democrats voted against NAFTA. They voted against the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, all the stuff that affects banking. And I don't know what was Clinton's deal. So, I mean, there is shared blame there, and that's why I'm not quite a big a fan of Bill Clinton as many other people. He signed the Communications Act.
Yeah, that opened up radio stations ownership, you know. That's
right.
How some of those, we work for a very very small but wonderful
we love it.
Company that,
you
Boss,
know, we love you. We love you.
Stop. You know, mainly radio stations and large markets and television stations, but you know, some you hear about these companies that buy as many radio stations as they want in a market, and they've taken radio down.
Although they're starting to eat it, though, like Clear Channel.
I wasn't going to mention.
That's okay. Okay.
Yeah, okay.
But one of the things is that goes way back. The deindustrialization, particularly of Detroit, goes back to the 1950s. And it never should have been allowed. It never should have been allowed by the United Auto Workers, which first began seeing its small shops and supplier plants go to the South because they didn't want to pay union wages. Then when it started going to Mexico, you know, in the 1970s and what have you, and then to China. And what we really need is an enormous protectionist economy with high tariffs. So the importing stuff is just way too expensive for manufacturers. Although the toothpaste is out of the tube, and I don't know if we can go back to
getting back in there.
What do you think, Tony?
Well, go look at these little industrial parks, you know, in and around the Detroit area, and half them buildings and little factories that they have, and half of them are closed up.
Right.
And those jobs will never come back, you know.
Well, so what are we to make of? Because I mean, one of the things that's going to happen is that as American wages collapse, particularly among working class jobs, and as we can see, these revolts over wages and the environment, mm-hmm. environmental conditions and working conditions that are going on in China, that their wages will start to rise. And at some point, people like Apple and automobile manufacturers and clothing manufacturers will go, you know, well, hey, we can hire people in Michigan for $4.75 an hour, you know, and so the jobs will all come back then. But that's not what do I think it will? I don't know. You know, I have to say, I don't know what the hell is going to happen. It don't look good. And part of the reason is because, and if you think about this conversation we've been having tonight, whatever part of you've heard, mm-hmm. we're always concerned is what are the elites going to do in for us? Are they going to screw us? Some people would say that all of them screw us all the time. Some of them, you know, like some people will say the Democrats screw us a lot less mm-hmm. than the Republicans do, which I would say. But there never is that sense of intervention in history. So we invent the future rather than hoping that an elite will create a nice situation for us. Sometimes they will, sometimes they won't. Sometimes you get a nice king, sometimes you get a madman, you know?
Right.
Sometimes you got a guy that's handing out wheat to the peasants, other times he's putting their heads on stakes.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I think John Lennon was singing that whole thing, you know, power to the people.
Yes.
Yeah, the revolution starts, mm-hmm. well, when?
Every Sunday night.
Thank you, Tony. Appreciate it. Here is Joni. Joni's in West Bloomfield. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, you guys.
Hi.
Hi.
Do you remember a lady called Leona Helmsley?
Sure. She was a hotel owner. And
sure. And she was in
there.
Her
she
famous
was
quote.
Was, and she left all her money to her dog.
Yeah, but what was her infamous quote?
You tell us. I'm sure. I know it, but you tell it.
Only the little people pay taxes.
Oh, right. Remember that? Right. Sure.
Yeah. You know what, though, Joni? She said what all the rich people believe. She was just stupid enough and coarse and crass enough to say it out loud.
Oh, no, she wasn't the only one. Lady Anne, that I like to spell A-Y-N, married to Lloyd Mittens.
Ayn Rand.
No.
I call her Lady Anne.
Oh, okay.
The wife of Mittens.
You mean
Mitt happens.
Romney's wife.
Yeah, yeah. Mitt happens. Yeah.
She did an interview on ABC's Good Morning America not too long ago.
Yeah.
That went viral when she got all huffy when asked why the American voters would not be vouchsafed a look at Mitt's latest tax return. We've given all you people need to know.
Right. You people.
You people. That says it all, doesn't it?
Yeah,
it really does.
And she's part of the horsey set, right? Didn't her horse even...
Dressage, isn't that what they call that?
Dressage.
Dressage.
I'm so straight.
Okay. Her horse cost us $77,000 to feed last year and house, and they got a tax credit for that.
Wow.
You can get a tax credit for your kid for $1,000.
I wonder how much it costs to ship that horse over to the Olympics.
$107,000.
Whoa. God.
Joni's on top of all this.
Joni, go girl.
I'm mad. I'm real mad.
Hey, Joni.
Good.
Joni.
Hey, mad.
Hey, Joni, are you the caller that told us about that demonstration in Lansing?
Vagina, yeah.
The vagina march.
Yeah.
I'm real mad.
Wait. Let me just reset that. Here, what we're talking about is this Democratic, either representative or senator, mentioned the word vagina, said that she was glad the Republicans were so concerned about her vagina, mm-hmm. and they disciplined her and said she couldn't speak on the floor of the House.
That thing hasn't died.
And so, wait a minute. And so then there was supposed to be a demonstration the next day, and this was like quite a few weeks ago. Did you go up there?
No, but I helped organize it.
And I heard all about it. Eve Ensler with the vagina monologues showed up, and they recreated the vagina monologues right on the steps of the Capitol.
And if people are wondering, what in the hell is a vagina monologue, just Google it.
A very successful
play.
Traveling play. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
A political play. Eve Ensler is amazing.
Yeah. All about said vagina.
but another thing, we've now, sort of like an addendum, there's an easy test to determine whether you're a feminist.
Oh, what is that?
Because I guess some, you know, some women are not sure whether they, I guess they're worried about the label, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah, maybe they'll scare men off.
Very easy to ask. Two questions.
Guys will think they don't shave their legs or something.
No, no. Number one. Okay, number one, if you have to put your hand in your underpants, do you have a vagina?
Wait, hold on. Yeah?
What are you guys talking about?
Okay, do you want to be in charge of your vagina?
Wait, yep.
Congratulations, you're a feminist.
Thank you! And I got to touch myself. I love it.
Hey, Joni. I got to go.
Bye, Joni.
Me too, bye.
Thank you, Joni. Actually, we do. We got to take our break, come back with our last segment. Sue and Randy and Mike, stay tuned.
And we have some open lines. This is your last chance to talk this week. If you want to call, 313-298-9743.
All right, right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Everything that rocks worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com. This is 101 WRIF. Thanks for rocking with us online at WRIF.com.
Can you feel it? Do it today. If you can't, then it doesn't matter anyway. You will never understand it because it happens. And it feels so good, it's like fucking the glass. It's so cool, so hypnotized. It's so groovy, it's out of sight. You can touch it, feel it, pieces of it. But it
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
All right, welcome back to our final segment, so please do join us at 1 a.m. A couple of really interesting interviews for you. Attorney Michael Stephen Smith, an old friend of mine who co-wrote a book called Who Killed Che Guevara and How the CIA Got Away with Murder, and he pins it on the agency, and also the co-host of a show called Law and Disorder that's carried by about 40 stations around the country. Also, Paul Clemens, a Detroiter, and he wrote a book called Punching Out, 1 year in the closing in a closing auto plant, talking about how the Bud stamping plant on Detroit's east side went down the drain. Mm-hmm. I mean, on the face of it, I'm always apologizing for things. It doesn't sound really interesting, but it was. And,
you might learn something.
It's a great Detroit story. For absolute sure. We have some emails for you. Do you want to read one?
Daywan, who's a regular listener and writes in to our email regularly, said, "Hey, guys, I have proof that socialized medical care is evil," he said. "I've been in the hospital since Thursday morning with a severe leg infection that's potentially fatal." I hope not. By the way, I'm quite shaken by that. Anyone who was part of our show. "I'm on disability and receive Medicare and Medicaid, which is covering all of my treatment and my private room. After my long-term aftercare of home IVs of antibiotics, yes, I just can't believe how evil it all is." he's joking.
Right.
"I'm such a bad American for not just curling up and dying, LOL." Well, we wish you the best, and please let us know how you are.
We're calling it. I'll try it again.
What?
Sounded like I was just clearing. Sounded like I was clearing my throat.
That was like you had some kind of other personality shooting out of your head.
Don't start. Raskolnikov. Raskolnikov. Ah, you look at me. I'm not even affected by
it. I thought you were doing the Ricola.
Now, Raskolnikov, which is actually a character in what? Crime and Punishment?
I don't know.
Yeah, I think so. I'm losing Dostoevsky. Anyway, Peter, I visit a couple of internet political forums, and it amazes me how so many individuals who probably don't have a pot to piss in and will never pay off their credit card debt will passionately defend the super rich. It is the same mentality that put Hitler in power.
Ooh.
Well, you know what? Actually, not really. The working class of Germany in the early 1930s was solidly behind the socialist and communist parties.
And it was only, 20% of the population?
About 30% is what Hitler got
in.
Yeah. And once he was able to become chancellor, well, then it was down the drain. And still, there was a lot more resistance in Germany, almost all based in the working class, than particularly mobilized by these left-wing parties. And so, I mean, one-third, I would say, always of any Western industrial country is pure fascist. And as I've always said, got to remember, the conservatives have always supported the fascists. They supported the Nazis, they supported Mussolini, they supported Franco, they supported on and on and on. And the communists, on the other hand, always attacked and eliminated liberals. Anybody that they considered to the right of. Let's see. We'll move on. And let me see. There was one more that... Did we read about the ghoul? The ghoul, I said...
You were saying that power to the
power
people,
to the people.
That we open our show with every week, that the ghoul used it.
Carrie, who is... well, we won't see where he's from because it's his business.
Yeah.
The ghoul used power to the people during his Q&A segments. At the end of his bit, he would say, "It's here, it's there, it's everywhere, it's running amok, it's running rampant, it's ghoul power, and it's taken over mama." It's taken over.
It's taken
mama.
Over mama.
Then he would play power to the people.
All right.
That's right. From
well,
Parma,
I feel even cooler because
from Parma, Ohio.
The ghoul is cool.
And a liberal in South Carolina who listens via the internet says, yes, it was Steve Earle who says the revolution starts now.
Yeah.
On that same album, he's got a great song that he says, F the FCC.
Mm.
F, you know, which
yeah,
says,
but we are not going to say that here. Yeah. Let's not even go there.
He said, in a few minutes, the Mars Curiosity lander is going to either, he says, land or crash. They're worried.
Oh, they are?
Oh,
this is the NASA landing?
The NASA landing on Mars. So I'm going to follow that. That could be. In fact, I wonder if, as soon as we get off, we'll watch it on the telly.
You're going to stay up and watch television after this?
Why not?
God.
Okay, let's go back to our phones. And
we do have open lines if you want to call.
Yeah, here's Randy. Randy's in Westland. Randy, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to talk about what you were talking about earlier about people voting against Obama. I don't really know anybody that's voting for Romney instead of Obama because of anything to do with Obama's race or anything, but I do know people that are voting for the Libertarian Party people because they're against some of the stuff that Obama's doing that is similar to what Bush did, like him carrying on with these drone attacks on people that are considered just innocent civilians. Mm. I personally really don't know too much about that stuff, but I do know a lot of people are going to be voting like for a third party, so I'm kind of worried it's going to be a little bit like when Ross Perot ran and maybe split the vote and could actually help Romney get in that way as opposed to direct votes for Romney.
Well, that's what I posed earlier. What does one do when you have a really good candidate on the left, somebody like Jill Stein, who's running for president on the Green Party, but that could very well help in particular states that would help, the Romney get in. One of the things that the Green Party advocates is trading votes. In other words, that to encourage people, particularly that you know, say in Texas, that you know is going to go for Romney. To vote for the Green Party, mm-hmm. but in Michigan, that they would vote for the Democrats. And again, I mean, I keep emphasizing is that the presidential election is important, but it's also what we do as involved, engaged citizens throughout the rest of the year.
And I also think it's so amazing. Is it Ramsey?
What that we're talking to? Randy.
Yeah. Sorry. That all of these people are like, we've got to do something, and all they're doing is typing on Facebook. They've never been to a protest in their lives.
Or a meeting.
Or a meeting.
Or
organize their own meeting.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, go ahead.
The other thing I wanted to touch on when I get a chance here is the job situation.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, they keep talking about jobs being created, but they don't talk about what kind of jobs there are, quality of pay, benefits or anything like that. They're destroying all the good paying jobs, the union jobs. And then another thing I don't know if you're aware of, they started building TVs in Canton, Michigan in March on a trial basis. I don't know if they're still doing it. But
really?
It's almost like we've become a third world nation now because it's because the people in China were demanding more money, and because of tariffs and stuff, they decided, well, it's going to be cheaper to build these TVs over in Michigan.
Sure.
They're just the final assembly. They're still getting the components from Taiwan and China. But, I mean, the only thing we can do is what you were saying before, is increase the taxes, make it, it's too costly to do this, where they have to. Like in China, they'll tax the hell out of us if we try to import anything over there. Why don't we do the same thing to them? Why are we giving them everything?
We owe them a lot of money, for starters. We owe them a lot of money.
Well, we should file bankruptcy like everybody else.
Well, I hope that's not in the future. All right, Randy, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Here is here's Mike in Jackson. Mike, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter. I'd like to ask you a question.
Sure.
Hear you out and know if I could give a closing thought when you're done.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's very formal.
That's what they say. Thank you.
Okay, go ahead.
What is the story on this Pete Hoekstra guy? I haven't been reading the paper because I've been going to the lake and stuff all the time.
Pete Hoekstra is he in the House of Representatives still? Is he Republican in the House?
He's out of the House of Representatives and he's running for the GOP
right.
Senate nomination.
To run against Debbie Stabenow, and he's being challenged. There's a number of people running, but Clark Durant is running against him. And the only thing I can say, if you see both their ads, each of what they say about the other is true.
Can I give my closing thought?
Sure.
The Ghoul was cool, and I love Rift sponsor, Deja Vu.
Okay. I like that better than any talk about Pete Hoekstra and what have you. Let's see. Here is Sue. Sue's in Harrison Township. Hi, Sue. Hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, how you doing? I'm a feminist, and I shave.
Well, hey, go girl. Me too.
Anyways, I don't know who is in charge of GM and Chrysler,
yeah.
but I was wondering if they're supporting Obama.
You know, I don't know, because essentially he saved their companies, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
If they aren't, then they're ungrateful, tacky, you know.
Well,
that's a great question. That's right. I like that one.
I think that they're probably laying low, you know?
Hmm. Do you know their names?
No, and that's terrible. The chairman of Chrysler is the guy from Fiat, isn't he?
I don't know.
I think so.
I think so.
My computer is dead.
It's not like it used to be. Well, we have John in the other room who will soon tell us. In fact, you know what happens?
Go, John.
You know, every talk show host has like a team of producers, and the host will have this screen in front of him or her.
Which we have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we have this little teeny weeny thing. I mean, they have lots of screen. So you would, call in, and the phone screener would say, "Well, what do you want to talk about, Sue?" And you tell him, and he'd say, he would have up on the screen, and I'm not faulting John. He can't do this. Daniel Akerson is the chair of the CEO of GM. Never even heard of the guy. Daniel Akerson, probably. And so that always, I remember one time I was listening to Rush Limbaugh. I mean, I can usually take about 3 minutes or something like that.
I hate when you say that.
And some guy was really bamming him with something that it was very clear to me as a talk show host that, that Rush had no clue how to answer. Cause I hate to say it, but it's happened to me once or twice.
You know the tricks.
I know the tricks, how to make it sound like you actually know what you're talking about when you don't. And all of a sudden, Rush said, "Yes, but in 2004, you know," and I know what happened. Immediately, they got
all this
information up on the screen for them.
Yeah.
Which is okay.
Mm-hmm. With us, it's all up here.
Oh, yeah.
Except for that.
And it's Sergio Marchionne, who is the former Fiat guy that's the chair of Chrysler.
Huh.
We have not. And so does that mean Sergio Marchionne is not a U.S. citizen? I don't know. I don't think so. I think he's from Italia. Okay. Sue, thank you so much.
Sue, thanks.
Okay, good night.
Keep on shaving, sister.
But I agree with you. You know, there is a good friend of ours who is taking a lot of photographs of us and photographs of the UAW. You know who?
Yes, I do.
She called in one time to a talk show here in Detroit and said she didn't shave her legs or under her arms.
Yeah?
They talked about this for 3 hours.
That's fabulous.
Yeah.
I love her.
All right, she may be listening. Oh, you know, she's always sending me, too, stories about how, and this is so tragic, all these
motorcycle
guys,
helmets,
that are getting killed at a rapid rate without wearing helmets, you know, by not wearing helmets.
Yeah.
All right, I'm not going to say the obvious. I wouldn't ride down the driveway without one. I guess I'll say
me
that.
Me neither.
Here's Mark in Southgate. Mark, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, concerning the Colorado shootings and the gun bans, it's a shame that you weren't in the crowd, you fucking douche.
Hit it, Peter.
Yeah, I will.
Right?
Yeah.
Thank you.
You know, I could recognize his stupid voice. I don't know why I didn't do something. Here is Bear and Wayne. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Did you say Bear?
Bear, I did. Is that your name?
Hey, how you doing, man?
Yeah.
Jolene?
Yes.
Good evening to you, or morning as it is.
Good morning.
In any case, look, guys. You know, there's a lot of things out there that we could do to help the economy. Like those people out there that are actually looking for welfare. You know, if they took jobs at a lower pay rate that would equal what their welfare was coming out to,
well,
those jobs that are overseas could come back here.
Wait,
the jobs aren't available.
And there's not any able-bodied men or women on welfare. That doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, Bill Clinton kicked them all off.
There's, unemployment insurance that all workers pay into, so essentially we're getting our own money back. But don't buy into that myth that somehow... You know, because they used to say during the 1930s, during the Great Depression, it was the same thing. Anybody that wants to find a job could. And by the way, the other thing that you're talking about is that whole driving down of wages. And that's what, was it Tony or somebody, was saying that, that we're starting to be like a third world country. I mean, for maybe a period of about 40 years, from 1930s and 1970s till Reagan took over at the end of the 70s, that there was this great increase in the middle class and the wages of ordinary working people because of unions, because of the minimum wage, that you know, we got Social Security, we got Medicare and all that. And what's trying to what's going on now, they're trying to drive us back to where we were in the 1930s. All right, thank you very much. Let's see. John writes, Marcioni commenting on Clint Eastwood. Are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
Marcioni commenting on the Clint Eastwood, it's getting late, super ad. I am certainly not politically affiliated with Mr. Obama. I am not supporting any politician at this time.
Just exactly what you said, Peter. Yeah. Even though he made a statement, he's laying low.
So John says, so yes, he is laying low on that front.
Yep. Thank you, John.
Can he broadcast from there?
Let's
really?
We're going to turn his mic on.
That's how you got started, didn't you?
No.
No?
No. I did get started. You mean answering your phones? Yeah.
Yeah,
I did in the old building, and I held up a sign to tell you what people's line? Names were,
and then you
asked me to join you.
Okay, on you didn't actually
the nationally syndicated
show. Yes, you did. You were in the other room
no,
at the time.
You never put me. You wouldn't let me crack that mic.
I remember there was
How
one
dare
time
you ever.
You were trying to signal me, don't go there. You're going to lose your job.
Oh, well, because we had a window, I was probably waving,
right.
don't.
And you were right.
Yeah.
All right. It was same-sex kiss day at Chick-fil-A, and that was a couple days ago, which draws kissing activists, as it says. Chick-fil-A is this chain, 1,600 stores, and Dan Cathy. Doesn't that sound like a gay name?
Peter.
I'm sorry. What's a gay name?
That was kind of stereotypical.
Yeah. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Anyway. And so there was this big kiss-in. Not as big as...
Because the CEO of Chick-fil-A basically, it was discovered, gives a lot of money to anti-gay and some really
right-wing
nasty hate groups.
Yeah.
So there's been this backlash. Mike Huckabee, who's a Republican, said we're going to support them. Amazing how many people are supporting these jerks.
Yeah, they actually had a lot more people for the supporters of him. But the kiss-in was peaceful, and individual owners of the Chick-fil-A affiliates were pretty good. They handed out free chicken sandwiches and water to gay rights activists gathered for the kiss-in.
Well, that was smart.
In Wichita, where it was, what, 112 or something?
Yeah.
In Decatur, Georgia, Chick-fil-A employees served lemonade to the protesters.
It's never too hot to make out, okay?
In Atlanta, where Chick-fil-A is based, partners Haley Key and Stefania Alanoki locked lips in front of the Chick-fil-A restaurant in the CNN Center. Outside, Roland Longino, an activist dressed as Jesus, held a sign that said, hey, I had two dads and it turned out all right.
Yeah, that's right.
There you
I'm
go.
Okay.
Hey, we're out of time.
We are, Peter, but we will be back next week.
Yeah.
Thank you to John. Podcast tomorrow at noon.
And
join us on Facebook.
Stay tuned. Yeah, Facebook.com/nightcall. And there'll be a podcast up at noon. Did you just say that?
I did.
All right.
Good night, everybody.
Stay tuned. Stay tuned for our interviews.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this. Detroit's rock station rocks worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com. Thanks for listening to 101 WRIF on the World Wide Web at WRIF.com. right here, right now. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Bingo, that's the one.
Everything that rocks.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know, one of the many things that surprised me about the Arab Spring, all the uprisings from Tunisia to Cairo and other places, was that one of the symbols of the revolt, it wasn't real prevalent, but it was there, were images of the Argentinian revolutionary Che Guevara. Che's image appeared in these crowds. And I was always curious how people related to him. I mean, in many ways, he was the consummate revolutionary who, after taking part in the Cuban Revolution with his comrade Fidel Castro, went off to Africa, then to South America, where he where his life ended in Bolivia in 1967. And yet you see this sometimes, the image, almost as a fashion statement. So it's hard to make a real sense of an icon. But there is also a reality to Ernesto Che Guevara as well, and also to the end of his life, where he was shot and killed in Bolivia. And there's a book that's come my way. It's called Who Killed Che? How the CIA Got Away with Murder. Now, this is an interesting charge there. We're going to investigate that. The book is written by my guest, Michael Stephen Smith. He's an attorney practicing in New York City, a board member of the Center for Constitutional Rights. He is the author of Notebook of a 60s Lawyer, an unrepentant memoir, and Lawyers You'll Like, and co-editor of The Emerging Police State by the late William Kunstler. It's co-written with Michael Ratner, who's the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City, and Michael Ratner has been my guest. Both are friends. Michael Smith, a good friend of mine who spent years in Detroit. We reach him now at his office in New York City. Michael Smith, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Peter, it's a delight to be on your show. Thank you.
And you, I forgot to leave that out. What I meant to say was I forgot to say that you're also the host of a radio show in New York, Law and Disorder. You can go to the website lawanddisorder.org. That's on WBAI, is it?
It is.
Yeah.
And 40 other stations around the country. Unfortunately, not Detroit, so you guys are going to have to tune in on the web, lawanddisorder.org. I host the show with Michael Ratner from the Center and Heidi Boghossian, who's the head of the National Lawyers Guild.
And we may have a special guest, although we're kind of hoping not. Charlie Parker may join us, right?
Yeah, that's my talking parrot. I just turned 20. We had a birthday celebration when he was 18, when he registered to vote.
There you go. Well, and Charlie Parker, I mean, sometimes he says things that we might have to edit out, but we can deal with that. All right, the book, Who Killed Che? I thought that was pretty obvious, and, well, let's start in a different way. The name of the book is Who Killed Che? It's published by Orr Books, and you can go to orrbooks.com. But let's get a little look at who Che Guevara was, the revolutionary. People often say the Cuban revolutionary, but he took part in the Cuban Revolution. Much of what we've known recently is from the Motorcycle Diaries. Can you tie this all in just sort of as a background before Che gets to Bolivia?
The subtitle of the book is How the CIA Got Away with Murder. This book, because we obtained documents, which we reprint in Who Killed Che, demonstrates the smoking gun that it was the CIA, despite their lies for the last 45 years, it was the CIA that killed Che. And this book sets forth the facts and circumstances that prove that. Che, to answer your question about who he was the oldest of five children, came from a aristocratic family in Buenos Aires. Family had more blue blood than money, however. He had an uncle who was the viceroy of Peru. He had another uncle who was the general in Argentina. His father-in-law was the head of the Constitutional Court and a respected law professor. But the family itself was quite political. Che, when he was two, got asthma, so they moved out of Buenos Aires and they lived up in the hills. And he educated himself, really. He never went formally to school. And he eventually became a doctor. He was so smart that after he came back from that odyssey that's chronicled in the movie The Motorcycle Diaries, he passed 10 medical school exams in 10 weeks and became a doctor. His initial intent was to do something that would help the world. He was very interested in mass diseases that hurt poor people. He spent time working in a leper colony, actually. But he finally went to Guatemala, where he tried to practice medicine, could never get a job, and he was there when the CIA hired a mercenary army and overthrew the democratic government of Jacobo Arbenz in 54, and he fled to Mexico City, and that's where Che met up with Raul Castro and Fidel Castro, and that's what eventually led him to Cuba and led him to a central position in the guerrilla warfare struggle in Cuba that led to the Cuban Socialist Revolution.
Well, Michael Smith, tell us your interest in the question of the title of your book, Who Killed Che? I mean, this was almost 50 years ago.
You know how it came up? My co-author, Michael Ratner, sent out 15 years ago a Freedom of Information Act request to the CIA, the State Department, the Defense Department. He wanted to get all the documents that he could. In those days, you could get those documents. Now you can't. Bush said, don't give him any more documents. The theory used to be, and we won this because of the struggles of the 60s, was it's a democratic country, it's your government, the documents they generate are our documents, and if we ask for them, they got to give them to us. Well, Bush, the second, ordered that the government no longer give people documents, and he said, don't give them anything, and if they sue you, we'll defend you. But we happened to get these documents. We got a whole bunch of them 15 years ago, and then 3 years ago, out of the blue, because we didn't even ask for them a second time, we got another bunch of documents. And these documents are reprinted in our book, Who Killed Che? The reader can decide for himself who did it. We are convinced from reading these documents and the scholarship that's come out in the last several years, a number of excellent biographies, we are convinced that it was the CIA, and we set it forth. Ask me about the smoking gun.
Well, I just wanted to say, too, the plural here is the co-authors, Michael Ratner and my guest, Michael Stephen Smith, who's they've written Who Killed Che? How the CIA Got Away with Murder. One of the things, as soon as I opened the book, I realized that there was this incredible documentation. Literally, documents fill about half of the book.
It's chilling, isn't it, Peter, when you look at them? I mean, they're real documents, all the cross-outs and everything.
Yeah.
It's creepy.
Yeah, but I thought we all knew this. I mean,
we didn't know. The people suspected it, but nobody could ever prove it. And the cover story that the CIA put out was that they wanted him kept alive, and that even though the main guy on the scene after Che was wounded and captured and put into a little schoolhouse in La Higuera in Bolivia, the main guy on the scene was a CIA operative named Felix Rodriguez, and Rodriguez said, well, we wanted to save them, but it was the Bolivians that overruled us, and they were the ones responsible. And that kind of cover story, the plausible deniability story, the lie, is what's held forth in the last 45 years. This book cracks the case. It puts it to bed. We demonstrate that, indeed, it was the CIA using the Bolivian military dictatorship, but it was the CIA that called the shots. It was the U.S. Army that trained the Bolivian Rangers in counter-guerrilla warfare, and it was that group, the 2nd Battalion of the Bolivian Rangers, that surrounded Che, that captured Che, and then turned him over. And it was the CIA that sent a man out there to the schoolhouse where Che was there, and they used their portable radio. They called into La Paz, and they got the order, and they transmitted it. And this obscure Army sergeant named Mario Turan, a guy in the Bolivian Army, took a couple of shots of liquor and went in and machine gunned Che. But it was the CIA that called the shots there.
Well, Michael Smith, let's fill in a few blanks. We don't have anybody scratching their head. People say, yeah, Che is kind of a radical. I see his image on T-shirts and what have you. Both of us have been to Cuba, and we know how the image of Che there proliferates, unlike other long-term governments, the head of the government is rarely portrayed. In other words, Fidel or Raul, he's not on their...
No,
not.
They're against that. They will not allow any kind of portraits or statues of anybody who's in the government.
But you do see a lot of Che around. So Che, who's an Argentinian who winds up in the hills of Cuba, the revolution is successful in 1959. And I love these photographs of Che and Fidel playing golf.
Because when Eisenhower played golf, he used to get a lot of press.
Yeah.
So Che said to Fidel, let's go out in the golf course and maybe we can get some press. They went out there in their army fatigues with putters and posed on the green.
And neither of them could play, really.
No, but Che was a good soccer player, and Fidel was a great basketball player and a great pitcher, baseball player.
He was indeed. In fact, scouted at one time by the Washington Senators, I believe.
Yeah.
But, all right, so Che Guevara, then he's going to be, there he is. They've won. They're going to construct the Cuban Revolution and forgetting about all the debates about how it, wound up one way or the other. How does Che wind up in Bolivia?
Che wanted to defend the gains of the Cuban Revolution by extending it. They knew if they remained an isolated, impoverished island, they would eventually be overthrown by the American government. The American government thought that Cuba was its own private property, going all the way back to Thomas Jefferson, who called it the fruta madura, the ripe fruit, and that it only waited a matter of time until the fruit would drop into the hands of the United States. And, in fact, the United States ran Cuba up until 1959 when the Cuban revolutionaries threw out Batista, their stooge, really. It was an instrument of the United States government. The government of the United States sent troops and trained Batista's army, but they couldn't hold up against the guerrillas. Che was like the number two commander at that time, and it was Che and the column that he led that cut the island in half at the famous Battle of Santa Clara, and Batista got on a plane and went to Miami Beach. The Cubans took over their own country for the first time.
And then, so Che gets restive, though. He's not happy being...
No, he gets restless. He had an agreement with Fidel from the beginning that at a certain point he was going to leave and try to do something in other countries, because he realized that you had to be an internationalist, that you couldn't just build a democratic and wealthy country in just one country, that it had to spread. They've succeeded in a lot of ways in Cuba. Still a poor country, but Cuba is the only country in all of Latin America or the Caribbean that doesn't have childhood malnutrition. Everybody gets a free education through college. The medical system there is world-renowned. But they've been under a blockade by the United States in terms of their economy since 1960, and it's been very hard for them to grow as a result of the constant pressure from the United States. But in any case, Che tried to break out of that, and that's why he went to Bolivia. It was the most unstable government in all of Latin America. It had 159 changes of government since 1825, and it was the poorest country, this landlocked, mostly indigenous people country in Latin America. And he went there to join with Bolivians in an international brigade to try to take on the American-supported dictatorship in Bolivia under General Barrientos.
Weren't they called the cocaine colonels, too? Was it those guys?
I hadn't heard that, no.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Well, let me, Michael Smith, let me pose this to you. There may be somebody listening and shaking their head and say, wait a minute, here's this guy, it's a communist revolutionary, he wants to spread communist revolution, and the United States takes him out. Why is that a bad thing? Why should anybody get exercised about the fact that there was attempt to create to maintain stability in Latin America?
I believe, and I think the listeners would agree with me, and believe also in the rule of law, and executing people, executing prisoners of war in a regular war or guerrilla war is illegal. It's a violation of the Geneva Accords. It's illegal under international and national law. And I also believe in trying to get the truth out. And so for both those reasons, we thought it was important to write this book to lay out what actually happened there. Secondly, Bolivia is only very recently broken away from control of international corporations. And the head of the Bolivian government now is the first indigenous leader in all of Latin America, a man named Evo Morales. And he's got a photograph of Che on his wall Let me give you a quote. Huh. In his inauguration speech, Morales paid homage to Che, and he said he fought for a new world of equality. And that's why I think it's important to remember Che. I think going back to your initial statement, that's why people were wearing pictures of Che on their T-shirts in Egypt during the Arab Spring, because he's a symbol of not just talking, but of fighting and identifying with the oppressed and joining them on their side.
Tell us about the photograph of your on the cover of your book, Who Killed Che, How the CIA Got Away with Murder.
It's an oil painting, Peter.
Really?
But it's an oil painting of a real photograph. And you have Che is lying dead in the laundry room of a hospital in La Aguera. He had been strapped to the strut of a helicopter after he was executed and flown to this hospital. And there he was in the laundry room in the basement of the hospital. And the CIA had accompanying his body, and then was down there in the laundry room with him. And the oil painting that we have on the cover, which shows a guy in uniform, but is the face is obscured. But the real photograph is a photograph of Gustavo Villaldo, who was the head of the CIA team in Bolivia. And he's in the real photograph of it. Villaldo, who was he? He was the son of a very rich man in Havana who owned a General Motors assembly plant and a car dealership, and the family was very much in support of the Batista dictatorship, and actually had to flee Cuba after the revolution when places like these dealerships and nickel factories and large tobacco farms, the phone company, the oil refineries, all of that was nationalized. The Cubans said, look, this is our right as an independent people. You you Americans own all of our farming lands. We'll pay you for those lands, but we want to nationalize them and run them ourselves. And we'll pay you according to how much you listed they're worth when you paid taxes. And the Americans wouldn't go for that. And instead, they stopped refining oil in Havana, which meant the Cubans had no gasoline. So the Cubans nationalized the oil refinery, then the nickel mines, then the phone company, and so on. And that's what became what's known as the Cuban Socialist Revolution, when the Cuban government actually took over its own resources. And Che was the person that headed that up. He was the head of the economic division of the government for a while. Then he became head of the Cuban bank. There's a funny story about that, I'll tell you. The story is that Che and Fidel and the other leaders of the revolution were in a room, and Che was asked, are you a good economist? And he raises his hand, and so they make him the head of the Cuban bank. And so somebody came over to him and said, Che, how can you, you're a doctor, an economist? Why could you say you're a good economist? And Che said, oh, I thought he said, are you a good communist?
I wonder, Michael Smith, if I heard that joke from you, but I heard it in Spanish when they said, economista, comunista, yeah.
He signed the currency, the Cuban currency is Chinese Che, just, you know, his first name.
Wow. Well, let me reintroduce you in the book here. My guest is Michael Stephen Smith with Michael Ratner. He is the author of Who Killed Che? How the CIA Got Away with Murder. It's published by OR Books, orbooks.com. You go to Michael and, well, the two Michaels' website for their radio show, lawanddisorder.org. Michael, is the book available there through that website?
You know, it's not. It only came out 2 days ago.
Oh.
But we'll put it up. In the meantime, go to orbooks.com, and you get it through there. $16, and it's an e-book also for $8.
Hey, you mentioned the identity of the man who actually executed Che Guevara. Has there ever been any conversation with him?
Yeah, sure. He's still alive, you know.
Really?
There's an ironic story to tell about him. He's living in La Paz, and people have come to interview him. He's older now, of course, and he lost his eyesight to cataracts. And the Cubans send doctors all around the world to treat poor people for free, and he was given a lens replacement, and he can see again. And that operation was performed by a Cuban doctor.
Huh. What does he say about his role?
He regrets it, and he drinks too much.
Hmm. Well, all right. Let's get back to it now. I keep hearing that noise. Is that the parrot?
That's my bird whistling. Charlie, be quiet. We're on the radio with Peter.
Don't start him. Don't start. I have to. I said at the beginning of the show, I am been longtime friends with my guest Michael Smith, and have actually stayed in the room with the parrot. And we should do a whole other show on Charlie Parker, named after the great jazz alto saxophonist. But that's not our purposes today. You said that the CIA, how the CIA got away with murder, which is the subhead of your book, Who Killed Che? But it had to have the order to kill Che had to come from somewhere. I mean, does the documents here actually
here's
say
the way it works?
Okay.
The team that headed up the hunt for Che was run right out of the White House by a guy named Walt Whitman Rostow. And you have a document in the book that you'll see, Who Killed Che. The document is on White House stationery. It's a memo from Rostow to Johnson, who was the president then. And the memo says, this is a quote, "The troops that we trained finally got him," end quote. The way it works is this. The CIA was set up in 1947. That was the basis for the national security state that we're now trying to survive under. In 1948, they issued an order called NSC-10 by a guy named George Kennan, who was the principal theoretician of the Cold War. Kennan said it was the biggest mistake he ever made in his life, but the NSC-10 set up the CIA as a paramilitary organization that could go out and do all these illegal things. So once they did that, they had to have a system to deny it, and it's called plausible deniability. So what would happen was the president would kind of make it vaguely known to the CIA what he wanted done, and then the CIA would go ahead and do it, but they wouldn't tell the president all the details. Richard Helms, who was the head of the CIA then, was deposed by a congressional committee, the Church Committee, in 1975 that was looking into America's roles in assassinating foreign leaders. And they asked Helms about it. He said, you know, we never would tell the president exactly what we were doing because we didn't want to embarrass him. So they have this plausible deniability, which is like an Orwellian term for lying. The CIA, up to the time it was created, to the time they assassinated Che, had killed or tried to kill 17 heads of states and countries around the world.
Now, the book is Who Killed Che? How the CIA Got Away with Murder. It's co-written by Michael Stephen Smith, my guest, and Michael Ratner. We just have a few minutes left, and you know, I asked you earlier, Michael, the importance of this, and you really said the importance, and partly to you, that as a lawyer, as someone committed to social justice, that you wanted the truth known, and also that an execution of a prisoner of war is illegal.
Well, there's, Peter, you know,
I didn't get the question out. What?
There's no statute of limitations on murder. The people that did this are still walking around.
Okay, but
they can be prosecuted. I know where they are. They're in Miami.
Well, okay, then that actually is a better answer than what I was trying to elicit. But tell me, do they have names? You know who they are?
Sure. Felix Rodriguez, who was there on the scene, who stole Che's watch. Che wanted it to be given to his son, John. He wears his watch. There's Gustavo Villaldo, who lives on a farm just south of Milwaukee, retired, a wealthy man. And there are other people in the American government that were involved in this who can be identified and prosecuted. It's only the power of the government that protects them, just like the torture is under Bush.
I wonder if you could do this, because we just have about 2 minutes left. The book Who Killed Che is a half essay, Che Guevara's Life and Death, and then the last half is an incredible document secured by Michael Ratner and Michael Smith under the Freedom of Information Act from the CIA and other parts of the U.S. government. But there is a Victor Hugo, the French 19th century French author and poet, that I think is worth reading.
Yes, thanks. Thanks for giving me the chance to do that, Peter. I'd like to read this. It's a quote about Jean Marat, who also was a physician, who was a leader of the French Revolution in 1789. And this is what Victor Hugo says about Jean Marat, which applies to Che, as our listeners will understand. And this is how it goes. They guillotined Charlotte Corday, and they said, "Marat is dead." No, Marat is not dead. Put him in the Pantheon, or throw him in the sewer. It doesn't matter. He's back the next day. He's reborn in the man who has no job, the woman who has no bread, in the girl who has to sell her body, in the child who hasn't learned to read. He's reborn in the unheated tenement, in the wretched mattress without blankets, in the unemployed, in the proletariat, in the brothel, in the jailhouse, in your laws that show no pity, in your schools that give no future. And he appears in all that is ignorance, and he recreates himself from all that is darkness. Oh, beware human society. You cannot kill Marat until you have killed the misery of poverty.
Hmm.
Victor Hugo. Viva Che.
Which is how the essay ends, indeed. And so ends our conversation with you, Michael. Michael Stephen Smith has been my guest. He's a practicing attorney in New York City. He co-hosts the radio show Law and Disorder. You can go to lawanddisorder.org. The book has just been published by OR Books. You can go to orbooks.com. There will also be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Michael, thanks for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Peter, it'll be nice to see you. Come visit us in New York.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werbe here with you. Well, here's a story about our city, and often we don't think of it in terms of good news. And one of the things that's laid us low over the last, and some people would almost say 50 years, has been the deindustrialization of Detroit. From the arsenal of democracy during World War II and massive auto production and hundreds of thousands of union workers making these autos that are sent all across the world, now, I don't know, what's the big industry here? Fast foods, pizzas, something like that. You know, there's a story there besides just the economic and technological end of it. There's real people involved, and not just the individual stories of the economic impact or the social impact, but a pretty expansive one. Joining me is Paul Clemens, and he's a Detroiter. He was born in Detroit in 1973. Paul is here, and I was looking for the book. He was nice enough. Thank you, Paul. Paul said, do you edit? I said, no. Here's proof of it. The book is called Punching Out, 1 Year in a Closing Auto Plant. Paul was born in Detroit in 1973, and he was raised on the city's east side. His work has appeared in the New York Times, New York Times Magazine. And his book, Made in Detroit, was a 2005 New York Times Book Review notable book. He's the recipient of a 2008 Guggenheim Fellowship. Best of all, he's here in the studio with me now. Paul Clemens, welcome to the Peter Werbe Show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, we're talking about the Bud Company. It had the auto stamping plant over on the east side. That was part of this galaxy of what made Detroit the Motor City. Tell us the basis of the book and why you chose the Bud Company plant.
Well, back in the spring of 2006, I was trying to come up with an idea for a book, and I knew I wanted to write about the decline of the working class or the troubles of the working class. But I didn't know how to get into that topic. It's a big topic, and you know, how to get your arms around it. Then in May of 2006, I saw the closing announcement in the Free Press and in the news and in the New York Times. It said historic plant on the east side to close. I was born and raised on the east side. I had heard of the Bud plant, and I thought that sounded interesting. It was in the city limits. It's between the Chrysler Jefferson North plant and the Mack Avenue engine plant for Chrysler. It was built in 1919 by Liberty Motor, and it's got a real claim to fame in that in the 50s, it built and assembled the body for the original Ford Thunderbird, one of the iconic cars of Detroit's 20th century. So there's a rich heritage there in that plant, and the fact that it had been there since 1919, and if you see it, it's an absolutely gorgeous administrative building. It's a replica of Independence Hall in Philadelphia. So, I mean, it's iconic in several ways. So it seemed to me that I could use that plant, if I did my job right and if I were allowed access to it, to tell a story about working class decline using that plant as a symbol of that decline. And that was the germ of the idea.
And did you get access to it? I mean, usually those things are kept under pretty tight wraps.
Yeah, I mean, that's a story unto itself, and I tell it quickly in the book so as not to bore the reader, but the obvious question a reader would have is, well, how did you get this access? So very quickly, when I saw the closing announcement, it came, it was in the paper, but along with that was a press release from the company. So I called up the guy who wrote the press release and said, could I meet with you? I would like to work on a book about this closing. And I met with a few people from the company, and they were great, and they said they would cooperate. A couple weeks later, I got a call and said, you know, as much as we like this idea, you know, it was clear that somebody above them didn't like the idea.
Well, I was going to say, usually the idea of a plant moving overseas or just closing, period, isn't real popular with the kind of image projection a company would want
there. Yeah, that's correct. I mean, there's nothing to be gained by having me in there from the point of view of the company, and I realized that. I tried to make clear to them, which is the case, that I was not writing, and I don't think I did write, a sort of muckraking book. I was not looking for corporate dirt or anything. I wanted to tell a very human story about the human cost of a plant closing and what happens after that closing. So in any event, I couldn't get in via the company. So you look for alternative routes. And as I say in the book, Detroit's a big city, and there's always a different way to get somewhere.
How'd you do it?
Well, when I saw the articles in the local papers, one of them, I think it was the News, asked for memories of the plant. And so I looked at those memories that people had posted, and some of them were extraordinarily moving. You know, my father, my grandfather, four uncles, whatever, worked in the Bud plant for decades, going back to the 30s, the 40s. So I wrote down some of those names, and I looked some of those folks up. And the caliber of people I met in researching this book was simply incredible. Everyone very helpful, with the exception of the company. And I got passed through several hands, and a lot of those people are in the book, or they're thanked in the book's acknowledgments. And one of the names I was given was the benefit rep for UAW Local 306, which no longer exists, on East Warren Avenue on the east side. And I got in with this fellow who's named Ray Dishman, great guy. And his father and uncle had worked in the plant going back to the 20s, I think his uncle had come up from Tennessee. So a really rich heritage, a great story. And Ray kind of helped me understand what is involved for employees in a plant closing. Ray was the guy who helped people decide, do I take a buyout? Do I take money in lieu of medical insurance or what have you? So that's an early scene in the book. Ray then gave my number to a friend of his after the plant had closed. The announcement was in May 2006 that it would close. December 2006, very early December, the plant did close. So after that, there was about a 3 or 4 month period where I didn't really know what was going on. By the end of April of 2007, about 4 months after, 5 months after the closing, a crew got in there that was going to start taking apart the equipment. And a friend of Ray's, who was another ex-Bud employee, whose father had worked at Bud for a number of years, beginning back in the 50s, was working with that crew. And Ray gave my number, passed my number along, and long story short, I got in with that crew.
Punching Out is the book. 1 year in a closing auto plant. We're talking about the closing of the Bud Company auto stamping plant in Detroit's east side with Paul Clemens. When by 2006, if this was, you know, if that company was had a pattern like most of auto, that was older workers, middle aged, that you didn't have a lot of young guys, huh?
That's correct. And by the end, at its peak, 50s or 60s, the plant was employing, I think, it approached 10,000. Never got quite to 10,000. But by the end, there were, you know, it was a skeleton crew. I went through that plant a few days before it closed at the end of November 2006, and they were kind of trying to ship out the final parts and so on. And it was nowhere near, you know, the 9,000 or whatever it had been at its peak. But it's an amazing facility. It's 2 million square feet. And back in the day, they used to call it the Mini Rouge because it did a lot. It made, wheels. It made stampings. Like I said, it built and assembled the Ford Thunderbird. It had its own foundry. Really an amazing facility.
Why did it close?
Well, the Bud Company was founded in Philadelphia in 1912, I believe. And this plant was bought by Bud in 1925. It had been built in 1919 by Liberty Motor, which, like a lot of early motor car companies, went bust. It's like any sort of industry with startups. The plant had its glory years, as you sort of laid out at the beginning, during World War II and after. But there was decline. You know, you would have to ask the people at the company what they thought was behind it. I heard various theories, but the company was purchased in the late 70s by Thyssen, German steelmaker, which then merged with Krupp, another German conglomerate.
A couple of companies with long history in Germany, but we won't go into that.
There's no need to go into that, but that might explain partly why they don't want a writer writing about a closing. But yes, your listeners will know what the history there. But in any event, so ThyssenKrupp, by the end, the plant was called ThyssenKrupp Bud. Mm-hmm. But this is Detroit, and everyone just called it Bud or
sure.
Buds, as we say around here, putting the apostrophe S
on it. Yeah, now we're working at Ford's.
Yeah, that's
or
right.
Buds, or Chrysler's.
Or Kmart's. I go shopping at Kmart's. Right, yeah. Sure. Kroger's. So no one called it ThyssenKrupp Bud. It was just Bud.
We should tell people what we're talking about. An apostrophe S isn't the name of the company. It's not Ford's.
Right.
Yes. Okay.
Right.
Paul Clemens, go ahead.
But in any event, it closed. And so the idea that I had, along was what happens then? And, you know, we hear a lot about plant closings, but I felt like I didn't know a lot about plant closings. And I think as a writer, it's always helpful to lead with your own ignorance. There's a sense of discovery as you go along, and hopefully you can convey that to the reader. So what I wanted to know was what happened to the people. And as I described a few moments ago, I talked to quite a few former workers, but then it's hard for me to describe to your listeners very quickly how big a 2 million square foot facility is and how much stuff is in it. And so the question is, where does it go?
Yeah.
Who buys it? What happens to it? And I thought that in telling that story about the afterlife of a plant, so it's closed announcing and its actual closing is sort of almost the preamble to the book. The main story of the book is what happens then. And I thought that what happened was fairly remarkable, and I think it was my privilege to be able to witness as much of it as I did.
Well, there's a part in your book, Paul Clemens, Punching Out, where you drive up to the closed plant in a pickup truck with one of the workers. Could you maybe?
Yeah, that was Ray Dishman. That was right before the closing. And I think we were in his Crown Vic, actually. But that was when I went through the plant days before it closed in early December of 2006. But I repeated that experience a great many times after it had closed. And the story that was sort of the pitch line for the book and the story of the book, if I had to put it in a sentence, is that it's about the American working class mopping up after itself. You have working class fellas, it was all guys by and large, working in a place that had sustained generations of working class Detroiters. But in the absence of productive work, working for one of the big three, putting cars together, I kind of got turned around. They had used a similar skill set to take apart the equipment.
Were the same men involved? Were they
in a couple of cases? Yeah. In the case of Ray, he was not on the cleanup crew, but there was another worker who was. But there were ex-UAW guys who had worked at the Rouge plant, mm-hmm. who came over. And a lot of them were younger guys who, if there had been work in one of the big three plants, would have been doing that. But,
is it too strong an image to say it's almost like digging your own mass grave?
That sounds like a bit of hyperbole, but when you go into a place like this and you just see it, it's such a saddening sight.
Yeah.
Yeah, that it almost doesn't sound too exaggerated. It's using the same skill set to take apart the stuff that made stuff rather than making stuff. You know, it seems, I think I phrase it in the book, as a wound somehow self-inflicted. You know, you take the same work ethic, the same skill set, and yet you turn it on its head. It's a rather saddening thing to watch.
You know, interestingly, I was without a job when I was in my early 20s and went over to the Bud plant that you talk about in Punching Out, 1 year in a closing auto plant, and saw people going in. They were hiring then, you know, back then. And I thought, oh, I don't think I want to do this, and fell asleep. I went into the back seat of my car, fell asleep. The only time I've ever been dishonest with my wife. I came back home, and she said, "Any luck?" I said, "No, they weren't hiring me." But because to me it was onerous work, and that's why I got into broadcasting instead of doing honest work, like so many other people do. But but what was there, which I didn't realize at the time, that was more than just onerous work. There's a whole culture there, and you talk about going back generations.
Sure, I mean you get a sense that there's a lot being lost, obviously, and what comes foremost to mind are paychecks and a quality of life. But you also feel, the more you reflect on it and watch it, that we're losing a certain amount of muscle memory. the skill set, again, to do this stuff. You know, it only takes a generation for it to go away, not being passed on from one generation to the next. It's hard to really wrap your head around what we're losing. It's not just monetary. But, you know, what I found in there, and this is another thing I didn't know until I started researching it, was that taking apart industry is its own industry. And so what's documented in the book are the different industries that are involved in it. You have trucking companies that have to take the stuff out. You have rigging companies who move the heavy equipment and get it on the trucks. You have scrap companies who come in and that equipment that didn't sell overseas or wasn't bid on at auction gets cut up into pieces and sold as scrap steel. You have the plant still stands, but in many cases you have demolition companies, you have environmental remediation, you have auction companies who come in and run the auction. That's the meat of the book. What happens after it closes? That all of that's in there. And what I found, I have to note that a lot of this just falls under the category of dumb luck, was just a remarkably diverse cast of people, because in the plant on any given day, I would hear German, Portuguese, Spanish. These are the people who were in there working to take the stuff out. They were from the foreign suppliers that were buying the equipment.
This increasingly is what's called the precarious workforce rather than the permanent workforce and unionized workforce.
Sure, there's no guarantees.
Yeah.
That's right.
And I was astounded that in your book you talk about a trade publication, Plant Closing News. That's
What I wanted to do, maybe I should back up a bit. When I first wanted to write the book, my publisher said, you know, you can't just write about one plant. It's got to be bigger than that. It has to have, you know, write about three plants. And I said, well, you know, I really want to drill down on this one plant. I'm from Detroit. I want to write about a Detroit plant. And so as sort of a compromise, I talk in the beginning of the book. I don't talk. The guy who runs Plant Closing News, a very articulate and humane gentleman, he talks about the sort of national scope of this. Because it's not just auto plants that are closing. It's not just plants in Detroit or Michigan or the upper Midwest. Plants are closing constantly all over this country. It doesn't have to be auto. It can be a textile plant down in the South, anything. And Plant Closing News documents it. And they document it for the people who read the newsletter and buy the newsletter are people in the industries I just said, trucking, demolition, environmental remediation, auctioneering. Because they know when a plant closes, they're business opportunities for them.
Yeah.
It's capitalism on the downside.
Punching Out is the book. It's published by Doubleday. The subtitle is 1 Year in a Closing Auto Plant. It's about the Detroit's Bud Company auto stamping plant on the east side. My guest is Paul Clemens, and you can go to his website, find a lot more, including video. You say there's
a video of the book and a lot of pictures.
Yeah, and Clemens is C-L-E-M-E-N-S. So it's paulclemens.com. There'll also be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E. .com. You know, I think people who aren't in a union, which is the overwhelming majority of people,
sure,
don't understand that there's a sort of a parallel culture besides just the work culture, that outside of work, that the union at union functions, everything from picnics to Labor Day marches, and that people are linked together in a much more integral way than ever those of us who come to work as solitary individuals. And so that always hits union members pretty strongly, because all of a sudden they don't have a job and that culture is gone too.
Yeah, I think the book came out about, 10 or 15 years ago was it Robert Putnam, called Bowling Alone? And it was about how the decline of these sort of traditional unions or church groups or whatever, and the decline of the sort of social network that sustains all of us, and how that's been collapsing. But I did want to have a lot of the union history in there.
That is a real social network, folks.
Yes, correct. I'm sorry.
Face-to-face human beings.
Correct.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Correct. But I wanted to fill that in, and so one of the scenes in the book, I travel to California outside of Oakland, and I talked to Irwin Bauer, a great, great character who worked at the Bud plant in his 90s now, but he was a very strong union member there in the 40s, and in fact, his roots go back to Ohio and the Little Steel Strike in the late 30s. So I wanted to trace a lot of that history as well. The book in 240 pages, which sounds like a lot, but isn't, tries to cover as much ground as it can. The history of that plant, the union element, and then, you know, where we are now, which is a global world where industry is going to go where labor is cheaper and where it can make a buck.
What do you think, I wonder if you got this out of the man, one of the reasons that companies have gone to other, maybe even the major one, is that, as you just indicated, Paul Clemens, that labor's cheaper, and that's, you know, labor is also called variable capital. In other words, you can get it at different prices, where that's one of the few things that you can either pay a lot for if it's unionized labor, or pay next to nothing for if it's being produced in China or Bangladesh or something like that. So some critics, you know, say that we union members, of which I'm one, have priced ourselves out of the market, and it's the cold hand, neither you know, punishing nor compassionate that's dictated it
all. That's the so, invisible hand, Adam
yeah,
Smith. Yeah.
So if we all would have agreed to work for $4 an hour, you know, the Bud plant would probably still be humming.
Sounds like a race to the bottom.
Yeah, it is. And
sure.
But so what sort of personal reflection do the men have that made that because of the unions, because of the New Deal, were able to elevate themselves into the middle class? How do they view all this?
Well, I'll tell you, the book, that's why the book is an elegy. I mean, that's the book, the subtitle of the book is One Year in a Closing Auto Plant. My editor said to me when I delivered it, he said, you know, this is kind of a weird book.
Huh.
And that's not what a writer wants to hear
No.
from his editor, first of all. But what he meant by that is this, that if the subtitle had been punching out how corporate greed ruined America, or mm-hmm. punching out how union greed ruined America, or punching out how NAFTA destroyed industry, something with a thesis, it would be a much easier book to pitch. But the book is not prescriptive. The book is descriptive. I'm trying to describe what happens. Now, in that description, you touch on a lot of the things we've been discussing. But the book really just tries to elegize this culture that is unfortunately been taking its knocks as of late. But as a writer, I'll give away the ending to the book. You sometimes worry about something being too on the nose, too good. I mean, sometimes something a little bit tangential works better. But the last scene of the book, the epilogue, I travel to Mexico. I fly to central Mexico, and the Bud plant's largest press line was 16 line, a massive press line that did body stampings for the Ford SUVs, Navigator, Explorer. And a Spanish auto supplier, Gestamp, bought that line for its plant in Aguascalientes, Mexico. And I had befriended the Mexican engineers who were in the plant for months, and they allowed me to go down for a couple days and see that line. Well, when I got down there, what I found out was that line, which again was from a plant that sat between, and still sits, between two Chrysler plants, is now stamping parts, was in November of 08 when I went down there, stamping parts for the Dodge Journey.
And
a Chrysler car.
What were the workers making in an hour?
Nowhere near what a UAW
probably
member
$2.
Makes.
I think that was. Although they took a pay cut recently, actually.
Well, the UAW did. That's another.
No, I mean the Mexican workers.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
I mean the UAW did as well in the last round of negotiations in 07, I believe that was.
So Paul Clemens, there's really not lesson. There's not a lesson here, is there?
Well, I mean, there. Look at there's.
It doesn't have to be.
There's a lot of opinion out there, and whatever I can do as a writer. I think is simply to illuminate and describe. People have their opinions on these issues, and I touch on them, but I don't really engage them because it wasn't the objective in this book. What I'm trying to do is just illuminate a process that I hadn't seen illuminated before, which is what happens when a plant closes. Where does all this stuff go? Who buys it? Why do they buy it? How do they get it where it's going? Another press line went to Brazil, so I talked to the truckers who took it down to the dock in Houston and was put on a boat for Sao Paulo. I find all of that detail fascinating. Now, embedded in that narrative, obviously, one can draw some conclusions, but I really don't put my hand on the scale, so to speak.
Where you went, in fact, we're almost out of time, and I know you got to get going, you describe what the area around the Bud plant was and the Jefferson stamping plant and all that. It was what's there now? I mean, all the buildings down, is it just this wasteland?
Well, the Bud plant still stands. It's 2 million square feet, and again, the facade of the plant is just remarkable. If people haven't been by it, it's a replica of Independence Hall in Philadelphia. It looks like something out of Greenfield Village. Not a lot of people see it, though. If you drive along Conner Avenue, the plant does not face Conner Avenue. You can only see it in profile. But it should be a destination for anyone doing a tour of Detroit plants.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the broadcast. The book is Punching Out, 1 Year in a Closing Auto Plant. The author is Paul Clemens. You can go to paulclemens.com. That's C-L-E-M-E-N-S.com. And there'll be a link on my site, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Paul Clemens, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Rip Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit. Detroit's Rock Station. On the web, thanks for listening to WRIF.com. Thanks for rocking with the Riff online. This is WRIF.com.
Feel the sadness burning in my heart. You left too early, final look. So many things I should have seen, but in your mind you knew it will. Holding on to all I gotta love, but Shakespeare seems so dark and cold. The fire burning down my happiness, but I will rain.
all of Drew and Mike's best moments delivered right to your computer or mobile device. The Drew and Mike Podcast, brought to you by Matt's Jewelry Brokers. For fast cash, call Matt's at 586-286-2866. Subscribe today at WRIF.com.
I would like to introduce you to the fine men who risked their lives and livers to make this possible.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The Riff.
Back through.